Welcome to Model Rail Radio. I'm Tom Barbalay, and this is being recorded live on Skype, February 8th, 2014. Model Rail Radio is the internet's only live recorded radio show where the topic is the hobby of model railroading. This evening we're doing things a little different. Normally, the shows go till about 8:30 p.m. Pacific. This evening, we're starting at 8:30 p.m. Pacific, with the view that we have a few UK folks that I wanted to record, and apparently they get up very early in the morning, and we'll have a chance to chat with them. But I wanted to have a chance just to chat with Mike Slater. Hello, Mike.
Oh, good evening, Tom.
And we have on the one and only Chris Abbott as well. I wanted to float a topic this evening, as has been the case, I guess, periodically over the past couple of years, but now considerably more seriously. We are looking at houses currently. And probably for the past 6 months or so, I haven't looked at track. However, I kind of emerged into N-scale model railroading over the past couple of evenings. And although I had whiffs that Atlas had basically given up on N-scale track, this seems to be the case now.
Mm.
The track options, particularly in terms of turnouts, seem to be almost exclusively Pico. I've heard that this mythical Hornby N stuff that I can get. But I'm just wondering, I mean, it seems to be an amazing time for the model railroading hobby. There seem to be a lot of new folk that are getting interested, getting involved, you know, starting once again, renewing their interest in model railroading. And yet the major manufacturer of ready-to-run track is just nowhere to be seen currently. It really strikes me as a phenomena which could only do the hobby damage in the short and medium term. And I know what I'm talking to folks who are, you know, beyond the use of, you know, regular ready-to-run turnouts. Although, Stephen Arnold, I've seen some of your track playing. I know you probably still use ready-to-run turnouts where available. What's your thought associated with this, Chris Abbott? What's your thought associated with the current problems associated with getting very basic elements of track?
I think it's probably a byproduct of just general downturn in certain parts of the economy and certain parts of manufacturing and a glut in the distribution channels. And if there's low orders at the vendor level, then they're not going to put any effort or impetus on output. And they want to do a lot of output at once. They're not just running, you know, 50 turnouts at a time. They'd like to do 50,000, right?
But here's the phenomena, and here's the thing that really concerns me. There's still no shortage associated with rolling stock and locomotives. In fact, in N-scale, there seems to be, if there's a glut of anything, it's rolling stock and locomotives currently. They still seem to be coming out with the same frequency, and they're certainly the same number. But for folks who are getting into the hobby, who are interested, I mean, it's somewhat a problem in HO, but it's beyond chronic in N. And it just makes no sense to me that there are, you know, 2-3 years ago, relatively easy to find a number of sources online, a number of hobby stores that carried Atlas N-scale. Mm-hmm. In the various varieties. Now, it's all, you know, sorry, out of stock. There seems to have been at least a year and a half without Atlas N-scale. It just seems crazy to me coming back and actually doing the investigation now that I can't get what should be, you know, the easiest to acquire kind of track.
Well, the biggest hurdle was manufacturing issues overseas in China, because Atlas, they used to make everything here stateside, and then they moved all their production of tracks overseas. And this past summer, they actually got their first shipment of flex track. It was a container full of HO Code 100, Code 83, and N-scale flex, I believe in both codes. And basically, it was a 40-foot container full of track, and it vaporized as quickly as it materialized. And a lot of it is the initial manufacturer that they had producing the stuff overseas in China basically told a lot of model railroad manufacturers, we're no longer producing our product or your product for you. Go find another manufacturer. And it took Atlas and a lot of other manufacturers a good year, year and a half to move the tooling to other factories or find other factories to produce the product. And it's slowly starting to come in with product out from these companies.
Mike, having some sense of general manufacturing and the way that this process works, I mean, historically, when I came to this country in 2000, I worked with a toy manufacturer that had, you know, factories in China. And the experience there was, and perhaps it was more competitive at the time, but the experience there was that if one factory couldn't manufacture for you and you had a certain degree of volume, there were 10 factories lining up to take, you know, whatever tools and dies you had or what have you to take on, you know, the new manufacturing. And yeah. It strikes me as really very strange that something that is so critical to the hobby, and particularly for newcomers to the hobby, as easy, ready to run track and turnouts. Now, there seems to be, you know, no shortage of Kato, no shortage of Bachmann with the, you know, the thick plastic and what have you. And I notice a lot of, you know, YouTube videos now, the entry-level folk are going straight to that, perhaps due to lack of Atlas. But it just strikes me as strange that, firstly, no company has come in to fill the void because, you know, it seems there's a huge gap in the market. The Pico stuff, Pico could have stepped up, but I've had a kind of long-standing correspondence with Pico associated with a variety of features, so I'm not assuming that they would fill the void. But, you know, it's striking that no one has filled the void and that this thing, this gap in the hobby is still missing. Now, you noted with HO that they had some HO Flex Track that arrived, right? But
I believe there was also N-Scale Flex Track came in that container also.
But they have roughly the same problems with HO, don't they? I mean, Atlas has roughly the same problems with HO. It's just considerably more chronic in it.
Well, the Flex Track was basically non-existent in all the scales from Atlas.
Mm.
And even in their O-Scale Track product line has suffered through this manufacturing changeover.
Mm.
There's cars that I had on order from even regular rolling stock train cars that it took a year and a half, 2 years for them to actually get produced with this whole entire manufacturing changeover. And Atlas wasn't the only one that was affected. There was a lot of other manufacturers that were affected. There was one S-Scale manufacturer that they ended up selling all their tooling to Mike's Train House just because they lost their manufacturing and they didn't want to go through the hassle of finding a new manufacturing source.
It just strikes me as really strange that the hobby is in such, you know, a phenomenon of growth, and yet the major manufacturer of track in the US, I think I'm pretty right in saying that up until this point, just has nothing to offer at the current stage. I mean, it's good for the likes of Tim Weres, because you could probably move people into, you know, hand laying considerably faster with such track shortages.
Tom, the train set stuff has never been a problem, right? The snap track, Brad snap track, and the Kato and
certainly
former Lifelike and Bachmann Easy Track. That's never been a problem because they make those things by the bazillion, right?
Yes.
And it doesn't matter how much shortage you got on track, people aren't going to move over to use Tim's stuff in the droves that he deserves, certainly.
Certainly.
But, you know, the manufacturers, my recollection, my experience has been that a lot of N-scale stuff sat on the shelves for a long, long time and wasn't moving. And none of the manufacturers were gearing up to do another batch of N-scale stuff, like in the quantities that they would need to do it to make it viable, cost-effective. So when, you know, the industry picks up, when the hobby picks up a little bit, and that buffer of material disappears off the shelves, none of the manufacturers are in a position to do anything about it because they have never assumed that anything would affect their supply chain. And they've given away their control over their product to somebody else who can say, get your stuff out of our factory at the last minute. And then they have to scramble. And it's egg on their face for not looking after their own supply chain. It's the same. If you're fighting a war, if you don't manage your supply chain, you're going to lose. It's the same in business. I have not a lot of sympathy for them because they brought it on themselves. But yeah, the hobby suffers because of it, because now you can't go and buy anything because it isn't there. And initial outlay for a new company coming up for all the dies and tooling would be huge. You know, it's not something you can do effectively with a 3D print. It has to be injection molding for the ties. Otherwise, you just don't get your cost effectiveness out of it. So I mean, even they're sold out of the microengineering end. They're sold out of all the Atlas N, Pico N you can get, Kato N you can get. But, I mean, unless you're doing everything with Kato Unitrack, throwing in the turnouts and stuff, it's going to make your track look weird. And Pico stuff is, what, code 80 and code, I think it's just code 80 in N. So, what are you going to match it up to in terms of track if you've got a whole pile of code 55 flex or even a partial pile of it? It doesn't match up. It doesn't look right. So that's my rant.
So, no, I mean, that's exactly what I see. And it strikes me as very, very strange. I mean, if it forces me into hand laying, I guess I spend more quality time watching Tony Ryan's videos. But
yeah, you could do a lot worse than watching Tony Ryan's videos. Okay?
Certainly. But the problem with watching Tony Ryan's videos is you just get mesmerized by watching Tony Ryan's videos. Maybe I need to like apportion Tony Ryan's videos for like one night a week and then work night for the rest of the time working on this track.
Yes.
Does anyone on the call have any insights?
The only thing I can add to Chris's statement, yeah, there were some product in the Atlas track line that when I worked at the hobby shop, which I almost did work there for 20 years, there was some product that was probably on the shelf from when I started there 20 years beforehand. Especially some of the oddball crossings that they sold that the average person probably wouldn't use on their home layout if they're following the track plans. But I think it's just going to be one of those type of key factors when there's enough of a demand for some of the product, then they'll rerun it and retool it up again.
Well, I mean, one would imagine as there would be no turnouts, a variety of fashion. You could get, I think, because they're so rarely usable, Atlas Curve turnouts still in a small number of distributors, but all the regular turnouts, they've been out of stock for at least a year and a half, 2 years, and it doesn't appear, even though a number of websites make very hopeful noises associated with them arriving in 2013, it doesn't seem to appear that this is going to be fixed anytime soon. And it really kills the scale, because if you're starting out in N scale, aside from, you know, maybe you'll start with Kato, and a number of folks online seem to be doing that, but yeah, it's a very, very strange thing. And in terms of the business size, what Tim Wirris has been able to do, particularly with his solderable track, the kind of wood ties and PC board ties interleaved. Yeah. He doesn't make that for N, though, does he? He just does it for HO.
No, the chocolate is done with the wood ties.
Ah, yes, you're right.
So I think it can all be done. In fact, with the chocolate, from what I've gathered, what Jim Lincoln did, for his homemade flux track, he just basically soldered the rail on, one rail on, and then laid his curves and or his curvatures for his flux, and then came back in after the ties were all glued down and soldered in the other rail.
So I think Bruce Wilson noted in the chat that Pico does do both code 55 and code 80. I spent a bit of time watching the DCC, and we've actually had folks on who've talked about the eccentricities of soldering Pico for DCC. Again, it strikes me, I mean, how difficult is it to make an Atlas-style turnout, which doesn't require the strange cutting and resoldering for DCC? Yeah, it's a very, very eclectic thing, but I just wanted to air it in model rail radio-dom that we will continue to cover this.
I'm wondering, and I'm hoping that I'm completely wrong, but I'm wondering, is this indicative of the future of the hobby in general?
Well,
there's just not the demand?
No, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot. Clearly there's a demand.
Well, it costs a lot of money to manufacture stuff, and how much of a demand is there now compared to the demand that there may have been, say, 10 years ago?
Well, we'll never know, will we? I mean, you need to be in the space in order to establish that kind of information. But it strikes me in terms of the releases that the releases have actually increased in terms of locomotives and rolling stock in the past decade. And a shortage of track seems to be surreal.
I'm not saying it as a fact. I'm just...
Yeah, I think you can speculate about these things. But aside from speculation, there's clearly a shortage and there's clearly, you know, online there seems to be a need. And as much as I searched online stores, I also found a great level of dismay dating back 2 years associated with the lack of Atlas N-scale turnouts. So.
And this could also be the way, I remember back in the 80s when they started to develop quality locomotives in HO scale and probably N scale too, they would release a certain locomotive for a short period of time, and you felt like you had to stock up on them because you wouldn't see them again. And I wonder, is it a possibility that manufacture, this is a whatever the word is, some sort of a plan by the derived by a couple of the manufacturers that they'll create a shortage, and then when they bring it out again, people will stockpile on the product, and they'll have a great, you know, they'll have a great sale.
Well, we do have someone who I'm going to edit out of a podcast who's indicated that they have a friend who works for said manufacturer, and apparently it's not quite that simple. Although, unfortunately, this person who will be edited out of the podcast accordingly doesn't actually want to come on and talk about this circumstance. But so I think actually it would be wonderful if there was something to kind of bridge the gap. And I guess Tim's offering that, Tim Werris at Fast Track is offering that to a certain extent for the folks that like soldering track and these kind of things. But for anyone who's moving from what, you know, Kato style uni track and the Barkman easy track offering, yeah, there's no midpoint here. It just seems to be that you go straight into soldering track.
In my limited experience in the hobby, I certainly don't consider myself any sort of an expert on the way the business of the hobby works. But over the 30 or 40 years I've been in it, you can always tell what the hobby is doing based on what the manufacturers are doing. And the person that told me that was Jim Hediger, an associate editor of Model Railroader, and a guy that really had his finger on the pulse of the hobby. And he would say, if you want to know what the hobby's doing, just look at what the manufacturer is doing, because they are only in it to make money. They're not in it for the good of the hobby or because it's relaxing to do. They were only ever in it for the money. So if you want to know what the hobby's doing, just look at what the manufacturers are doing. And I'm wondering if this is the manufacturers are trying to tell us something.
Well, according to the anonymous person in the chat, this is an embarrassment, and it's not intentional. It's based on bad factory relationships in China, which seems pretty indicative of what happened with the shift of Barkman manufacturing and other manufacturers that couldn't actually jump the gap in China and were just knocked out. So I just wanted to throw that out as a topic. Murray Schulz.
Hello, Tom.
So what's it like in Australia? Do you guys have ready-to-run track shortages currently, or are you still getting stuff through in China?
There seems to be... I haven't been buying track. I did buy some micro-engineering ON30 track that I had to wait 6 months for. Australia's like everyone else when it comes to track. I think we just rely on the usual suspects like Pico and Atlas, Shinohara, that sort of thing. I do know that the HO manufacturers that are making rolling stock and engines have had a lot of trouble getting stuff out of factories in China. I think 6 or 7 years is the record for the time an engine was announced and it actually arrived on our shores. So, and I don't think it was with problems with the factory. I think it was just, well, I'll rephrase that. I don't think there was bad blood between the manufacturer and the factory. I think there was just lots of trouble and possibly the factories taking on far more work than they could actually handle.
You're familiar with the work of Kieran Haskell, I'm assuming, associated with his...
Yes, I'm hoping that one of his locos is in the post and will be arriving tomorrow.
Very good, very good, very topical. He seems to work in very close proximity with the factories that he deals with. I mean, he's a smaller scale manufacturer. But certainly my experience working for a toy company in, like I said, in 2000 was like that as well, that we had people that were either on the mainland or pretty close to the mainland and able to resolve these kind of matters relatively swiftly. I mean, you know, decade and a half ago, probably different times than it is now. And a lot of these factories, I think, were very competitive at that stage to kind of take business away from other factories and these kind of things. But yes, it does strike me as a strange problem, but I don't want this topic to dominate this evening's conversation, particularly when I have someone such as yourself, Murray, on the line. Do you have any model railroading updates?
Yeah, I've been doing a little bit of work on the layout, Tom. It's been incredibly hot here. We're having a very hot summer, opposite to what you guys are having in North America, I think, which means I don't get a lot of work done, but I have managed to finish laying track on the layout, so I've been able to run a train from one end to the other, which has been a major achievement. It's been I think it's taken me nearly 3 years to get from where I had a drawing on a piece of paper to where I can run a train the entire length, which has been very pleasing to get that done.
Mm. And now you're 100% authentically Victorian. Does that make the job a little easier?
No. I think it actually makes it... it makes it... it's easier to get things looking better, but I find that I also spend a lot of time looking at pictures and researching, which is also a good thing.
Mm.
I think it gets me a much better and more accurate model. But you can bet your boots, I just finished building a little the transfer table where they used to put the narrow gauge wagons onto standard gauge wagons. So when they wanted to take back to the workshops in Melbourne to repair them, and I finished building it, and about not 10 minutes later did I find a photo that showed it different to how I built it.
So you are allowing yourself a little artistic license in these circumstances.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going to rip it out and do it again. I'm not that pedantic. But it certainly is quite rewarding to take a photograph of a scene and try and replicate it accurately. And I've been doing that, building this the transfer area where they used to transfer the freight from the narrow gauge to standard gauge wagons. And, yeah, it's good fun to... study up all the photos and try and get all the little details right. And, yeah, it's just, I think there's a sense of satisfaction you get out of putting a lot of effort into something that, you know, money can't buy. It's just hard work and trying to strive for something better that gives you the satisfaction.
Certainly, certainly. And you actually put the photos up above your layout too, don't you?
Yeah, they're stuck on the valance above the layout, so I can. I found that it was too easy to just wing it and sort of go, "Oh yeah, that's how it is." And when you're building it, but when if you put the photos above the layout, I just can take a step backwards, look up, and go, "Oh, that's not right." And so it seems it's working for me to get a lot more accurate models.
And you're working from black and white photos, I'm assuming.
Yeah, there is some colour photos because they the Beach Forest line ran until the 1962, so there was a few colour photos taken. But, yeah, most of the photos are black and white that I'm working from.
And in terms of the structures and the environment, I mean, some of those structures are still there, and I'm assuming the environment is relatively similar, although there have been major bushfires. So, I mean, how... I know that you've seen some of the structures and you photographed some of the structures that you planned on putting on your layout, but how extensively do you use the, you know, as things stand currently in your layout design as well?
I do try to backdate it and not use it exactly how it is now because now is 60 or 70 years after when I'm modelling and things have changed a lot. Even with the best of maintenance, it still deteriorates. Well, things here do anyway. And so I do use a lot of photos to try and base my models on. It's a bit hard using the black and white ones to get the colouring, but for the rest of the modelling, it's very useful and very easy to build a model from. Some of the colouring stuff, like brickwork and that, never changes colour.
Certainly.
But trying to find those colours, what things are painted, what colour schemes were in the 40s and 50s is probably my biggest challenge at the moment because there wasn't a lot of colour photography around. But it's amazing what you can find on the internet. You do a search for areas and time periods and there's a lot of so much stuff on the internet now. It's amazing.
Certainly. In terms of the books that you're reading, Murray, how close do they come to the source material for you? I know the Victorian Railroads are pretty... well written about. You have actual source material, but what kind of numbers of books do you have associated with your layout?
That's a really good question. My wife's in the background saying 10 million.
Too many.
I'd probably have, that's a good question. I may have as many as 20 books on the Victorian Narrow Gauge. Puffing Billy Society, Preservation Society printed quite a few here about 10, between 5 and 10 years ago. And most of those are pictorials, so they're just gold for someone that's modelling. And, like, yeah, anyone that's modelling a past era, photographs are just so valuable because it's the only way you can sort of find out what's going on, how they did stuff. And, yeah, if you can, and I just love studying them and sort of planning and building. And I know you can't build things exactly the same, but with good photos you can build very accurate models. And there's also a lot of plans available even on the internet. You can search, there's some great resources with various plans. The government rail drawing up everything, so there's always plans missing of what you want to build, but enough that you can get by usually.
Well, seeing the YouTube video that you put up probably maybe 6 or 9 months ago associated with your layout from end to end gave me a real sense of the space. And now that you've run a train from end to end, I can see that that's an important milestone. How much additional track work do you need to do on the layout, or are you pretty well done in terms of track?
Almost completely done. A few sidings to put in, maybe a little bit of rehashing of one of the towns. Shift a few passing tracks in that, and otherwise hopefully with a bit more rolling stock. I've built a bit of rolling stock while I was away over at the beach on holidays in January.
Very good.
So I've got another 6 wagons on the layout, so if I could get another 4 or 5 built, I'd probably have enough to actually do a proper operating session. That's my next goal, is to get that happening. I've got a few people coming to visit at the end of February, and I think Dan Pickard and Laurie Green and Grant McAdam are calling in on their way past to an exhibition in Sydney. So
wonderful.
I've got my head down and backside up trying to get things ready for them to come and maybe run a few trains.
Yes. So with that number of folk on your layout, Do you think you have enough track to keep that number of people busy currently, or is this really what you're working towards to add enough interest, or is your plan just to have 2, maybe 3 people running at most on your layout?
Most of the time it'll only be 1 or 2 people. Where I live, the nearest modeler is at least an hour's drive away. So to be honest, it's usually just going to be me, and that's how the Victorian narrow gauge ran. You know, make up a train in the yard next to the standard gauge, work it up the line and work it back. And with shunting and so forth, I expect that should take between 1 and 2 hours. It takes a good 6 to 8 minutes to run an engine from one end to the other now without stopping. So for a little narrow gauge layout, that I think that's going to keep us occupied. And if I've got more than a couple people here, well, we'll be unprototypical and we'll run multiple trains.
Oh, the dangers.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, life's too short to be too technical and prototypical, isn't it?
Certainly. So you're expecting a locomotive to arrive tomorrow, and I think you're the first actual account that I've heard of someone who may be potentially running this particular locomotive in the near future, so we'll need to get you back on, Murray, to do an extensive review.
Yeah, that'd be fine, Tom. I've seen there's a few people in Melbourne that have been able to pick them up from the hobby shop that have posted photos on the internet, but I haven't seen a video of one running on a layout yet. So if I can get a DCC decoder into mine, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we might be able to have a video up on YouTube showing one running and showing off the layout.
Terrific. And do you plan to do any major modifications to it, or will you basically run it out of the box?
I will give it a good weathering.
Yes.
Definitely, that's the first thing that will happen. They didn't change them a lot, so I'll try and I might add a few details to it to make it look like a specific locomotive, but otherwise it'll just get a good weathering and, hopefully it'll just run.
Very good. Well, now you've said you're going to put a YouTube video up. Murray, I'm going to have to hold you to that, and I look forward to seeing the YouTube video when it comes up. And, yeah, post-weathering, pre-weathering, I'm not really fussed. Post-weathering might be slightly nice, but whatever you can put together would be much appreciated, Murray.
No worries, Tom. It might be a little while because it's about 40 degrees Celsius out in the moment. So we're in the, we've had, I think it's probably about 20 days of plus 35 degrees Celsius, and it just keeps going on and on. So it could be a while before I get out there with it, but as soon as I get it up, I'll let you know.
Does the heat hold in the evening, or does it cool down in the evening where you are?
Depends a bit. It's some nights it gets down nicely, but the last few nights have sort of been hanging around those like 28, 29 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
It's just everyone's a bit over it. It's been a very, as John Garrity says in the chat, it's been a very long hot summer here in southern Australia, so, and no end in sight.
Well, hopefully you don't have any trouble with any fires, but
yeah, there's been a bit of them around. We could see three from our house when we got home from holidays, which is, they were all, the nearest one was 30 kilometres away, which is close enough. But I'd like a shower of rain to take away the heat and the fire danger.
Yes, my uncle has a property in the Adelaide Hills that was burnt up to the house last year. And he'd actually been very lucky, maybe, you know, three major bushfires in the past 20-odd years that had come close. But this was the closest one that came to the property. And the, you know, the photographs soon following. And he stayed there with his son, which always kind of chills you to the bone when you see how close the flames come. But yes, it is a real phenomenon. Well, stay safe, Murray. And when you get a chance, please do post some YouTube of the new locomotive running on your layout.
Not a problem, Tom. Good chatting to you.
Always a pleasure, Murray. Stephen Arnold, last time you were on, you were talking about getting together with some folks in your area and seeing some layouts and talking to other model railroaders. Has any of that come together?
I'm still going over to Steve Priest just about once a week, working on his layout. He has about, well, usually a good eight guys or so, usually comes over every Tuesday. And then on Saturday mornings, as much as I can, I meet a bunch of other guys for breakfast, and then we go over to a hobby shop and then break off from there. Some guys will go to operations and stuff there. I've been invited to about three op sessions, but I haven't been able to make them yet due to work commitments and stuff. And then, but probably 2 weeks, I'll be operating on a guy's layout here in town, either the Chicago Great Western layout and, HO scale. So I'll probably about 2 weeks for that. It's a big Prairie Rail operation sessions, coming up, 2 weeks from now, where about 30 of the operating layouts in the Kansas City area here and be open, with a bunch of invites of guys coming in throughout the U.S. I'll be operating on these guys' layouts, and I'll be working on one of them. So,
very good, very good. Well, if you're going over to Stephen Priest's place on a weekly basis, make sure you remind him of his obligation to call back into Model Rail Radio, because I don't know, I think we talked to him maybe 3 years ago now, and it was just such a wonderful time just chatting, and we went into a post show. So please do, as you are now the local representative of Model Rail Radio, please do mention us in a positive light and ask him if he'll come back on. For folks listening in, what does, I mean, Stephen introduced his layout when he was last on, like I say, 3-odd years ago.
Yeah.
What's his layout like?
So he has a new layout now. That old layout was the Emporia sub. That was been in Model Railroader. That's been published and stuff. They bought a new house, so he tore that down. He saved a lot of the structures. And now he's redoing a new layout in the new house. He commandeered probably all the basement plus underneath his garage too. Plus he uses a lot of that for his publishing company as well.
So,
but I think it's about a 3,000 square foot layout he's going to do.
Gosh.
It's another Santa Fe layout because he's a big, big Santa Fe guy. He actually accommodated, he got all the Santa Fe records and from the engineering department. So, he's got a lot of the information for the railroad, and he's doing a fictitious route of the what-if scenario if the Santa Fe had built from Kansas City to St. Louis.
Gosh.
They never actually did that. They built straight from Kansas City to Chicago, and they bypassed St. Louis. So he's doing the what-if if they built there. Plus, he's going to have a branch line as well, and he's going to do it in the mid or late 1970s.
Gosh.
So we'll have intermobile.
Yeah.
Plus all the likes of your normal Santa Fe stuff. So should be an interesting layout, and we're moving right along. We got most of the good, probably 2/3 of the BenchWorks probably up right now. Plus, backdrops are getting painted, so we'll be able to start laying some track here pretty soon. He's going to do all hand laid track on this new layout. It's going to be all fast tracks. He's doing, he's got all the jigs and stuff, so he's going to do all hand laid track this time around.
So a question, I'm not asking you this, Stephen, in particular, but you might know this, but a question for the chat, because there seem to be a number of folks who would know this. When did the arch go in St. Louis? Was that the 70s or the 80s? Would he be modeling or at least giving a hint of the arch in his layout?
You know, I don't know when that went in. Is that the 60s, maybe?
Potentially so. I mean, I'm just thinking.
So I'm thinking it would be in his era, but I'm not sure off
Mike
the top
Slater's
of my head.
Googling for us, so let's move on. Mike will give us the details. So that sounds like an amazing layout, like a what-if scenario with St. Louis.
Yeah.
And this is at the tail end of, like, American big industry. Maybe it's at the very end of American big industry that obviously is kind of around St. Louis as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, do you get a sense of what the main features on the layout are going to be?
Central Missouri, which is basically where he's going to be going through, it's a lot of rolling hills, farmland for the most part, along with you got the Missouri River, so you got the river bluffs and stuff as well. So you're going to see a lot of that. So a lot of agriculture primarily. You'll see it in terms of online industries, agriculture related. And then you got the large industrial bases and interchange traffic points of the Kansas City and St. Louis area. So he's going to do a lot of through traffic, I would guess, with intermodal freight. He's planning on running a lot of intermodal from what he was talking about. So it looks like primarily it'll probably be a lot of through traffic, of interchange traffic going between those two, large points. Cause back then, I mean, Kansas City probably back in the 70s probably had 10 different railroads at the time. And then St. Louis probably had a good equal number, if not maybe probably more coming to those points. So you got a lot of traffic going between these areas. I mean, Kansas City, even today, is probably the second largest in terms of density of traffic in the U.S. behind Chicago in terms of just rail traffic in general.
Certainly. And St. Louis is a major hub for crossing the Mississippi as well, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So you're getting a lot of stuff going through there that's, you know, bound east,
going
bound
to like
west.
The southeast, heading to Memphis, Nashville, and the south. Yeah.
God.
New Orleans.
So much potential. So agriculture, heavy industry, city hubs. I mean, just a whole lot of stuff that could go into that layout.
Yeah. I think he's going to do mainly staging for the two. He might have, I don't know. I think he's going to do mainly staging, I'm thinking, for St. Louis. I don't know how much he's going to. He might have a yard. I can't think on the top of my head off his track plan, but I think it's going to be mainly focusing on the in between points with a branch as well.
So it sounds like you don't need a home layout for the foreseeable future.
No, not right now. I mean, that space and time. I mean, this stuff alone, I mean, keeps me busy enough. And then getting married in 4 months, so that's
congratulations.
Thank you. And so that's keeping us busy here as well.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I got plenty of stuff to do.
Well, yes. So you've got your operations covered. You've got your major layout build covered. I mean, aside from Stephen Priest, there are a number of other folk in your part of the world that are, you know, NMRA, MMR kind of qualified.
Yep.
So you're probably learning from the right bunch of masters there, Steve.
Yeah, there's a good amount. I mean, yeah, you got Miles and Fran Haler in the area too. The guy's layout I'm going to operate on, they built a bridge for him. It's the Chicago Great Western's, one of their big bridges they did. And it's probably a good 20 feet long, this bridge is. And they actually built it all in one piece. They brought it over in one piece. He was telling me about it. And they moved it all into his basement downstairs in one big piece. It's quite the bridge. It's actually on YouTube too. If you look for Mike Porter's CGW layout, there's a video of a couple trains crossing the bridge, and it's quite impressive.
Mm. Yeah, to have a basement entrance that enables you to take a 20-foot straight thing through
yeah, is pretty impressive. He's kind of built on a hillside a little bit, so okay. He can come from the back. That's probably how they brought that in. That was during kind of part of the construction phase, so he was able to bring it in.
Very good, very good. So, well, it sounds like over the next 4 months at least, you've got some pretty tight planning to do, so I won't ask any questions about immediate things coming up in your model railroading interests, aside from the fact that, you just seem to be smack bang in the middle of model railroading, you know, endeavors, and it sounds like, amazing opportunity. I mean, Stephen Priest, in terms of just the breadth of research material that he has at his fingertips.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the ability to, utilize that through proximity as well, and you could build when you do have the time and the space, you could build a highly detailed research layout in almost anywhere in North America and maybe even further afield based on the stuff that Stephen Priest holds. So.
Yeah, he's got a lot, and he knows, he's very well connected too. I mean, he knows a lot of people being in the publishing industry for the railroads as well. He knows a lot of people. He knows my dad as well, and he respects my dad a lot for the photographs and stuff, and he knows a lot of people. So, yeah, there's definitely – and all these guys here, ton of information and valuable stuff. They're all extremely knowledgeable in their particular areas of interest.
Well, Stephen, you're going to have to give me your postal address, because what I'll do is I'll send you some Model Rail Radio mugs that you can just leave at Stephen Priest's house. We'll get to him eventually. They all always right. come around. They always come around. So email me your postal
address.
I will.
I'll bug him next time I'm over there. We've gotten some heavy snow the last Tuesday here, so when it wasn't able to come over, but I will get on him on that.
Well, always a pleasure chatting, and no doubt we'll talk sometime, sometime in the near future. But if I don't talk before your wedding day, congratulations, and
thank you.
All the best with that. All the best.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Peter Burr, what's been going on in your model railroading hobby?
You know, I have a layout already that is under construction that is 2 feet by 20 feet, a semi-rural switching layout. And as I have explained, I suddenly have at least a 50% increase in the area that I can use for my layout. But the interesting thing for me right now is that, I'm sort of torn between hurrying and using some of that space to put some track in versus, just continuing to work on what I have. And it's like an L-shaped space, and the corner is where my workbench is. So, it's like, do I take over this space and build the layout into there, or do I just kind of lay back and continue to work on some of the things I've been doing already? Which is kind of a luxurious position to be in.
It's always good to have space. Do you think you might use the new space potentially for staging track or test track or this kind of stuff?
I think what I'm going to do, what I have now is, my original plan had a central element, which was, this special model of a mill by a river with a bridge and so forth. It was going to be sort of in the center of my existing 20-foot layout. With potentially a fiddle yard on each end of this, and on to the left of this central thing was going to be just a hint of an urban area with a few bigger buildings and a few urban sort of ideas there, and then another fiddle yard over there. So I was going to, be switching back and forth, and trains would originate on one end and they'd go to the other end, and these would be removable fiddle yards and all that kind of thing, which would, you know, I'm sort of intrigued by that whole idea. It's kind of a foreign thought for many people here in the United States to envision that kind of a layout, I think. You know, I might be wrong about that, but I think that that's far more commonly looked at as being a paradigm for a very small exhibition layout in sort of British or European concept. Well, rather than, you know, if you have a space like I have, which is probably almost 30 feet long by 16 feet wide, but most of that space is taken up by all the other things that we do. Mm. You know, my wife's jewelry business and all the, you know, things that are associated with that, tables and shelves and all of that kind of stuff, take up most of that space. So I'm around the periphery. And now, you know, we've changed the arrangement of one end of the room so that our office is not going to be there. And now, so now I can extend my layout from a straight layout to an L-shaped layout that now will be about, 24-25 feet long on one leg and about, I guess, 14 or 16 feet long on the other leg. Mm. And I think that what I'm going to do with the new leg, you know, I'm kind of torn. On the one hand, the idea of having a real engine servicing facility appeals to me a lot. Mm-hmm. Especially since I've just gotten this fancy brass engine that I've been trumpeting all over Facebook about. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that really appeals to me is the idea of having some kind of a waterfront scene.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you, Peter, actually.
Yeah.
Because when you describe the ability to have, I mean, I guess what are described as cassettes or movable track and putting things on and off. The prototype that people return to for this, and this is certainly in North America as well, it's not just, you know, Europe and smaller layouts, is Rail Marine. So if you have a waterway, you have the potential for some kind of Rail Marine, either industrial Rail Marine, potentially passenger Rail Marine. I mean, there's a wide variety of possibilities there. It doesn't necessarily have to be prototypical, but if you have some water, you can put, you know, some kind of carrying barge or something like that that can take, you know, boxcars and various other things as well. Have you thought about Rail Marine at all?
Absolutely. That's a real possibility so far as, you know, sort of a substitute for a fiddle yard. But what really attracts me about the waterfront is sort of like, you know, the main waterfront, the Waterville and Wiscasset Railroad and that sort of thing, you know, the old main narrow gauge, you know, little small trains with just a minor thing going on, you know, by the water, sort of like Ian Rice's trying to remember what he called it, the Roke something or other. Yeah, absolutely. Some sort of a barge arrangement is a great substitute for a fiddle yard or a complement to a fiddle yard. I'm just not sure yet what I want to do with that space. And as I say, at first I thought I was going to be, you know, gangbusters trying to put track in there. And now I'm not feeling nearly the pressure to do that. You know, I feel like I'm just going to sort of, you know, let that percolate in my mind for a while.
Very interesting. Well, it's a luxury to have space, Peter. Don't sniff at space.
No kidding. Absolutely.
And in terms of the other layout that you're working on, how has progress gone with that? Have you been able to...
Well, we have all of the track elements are in place. And my next project actually is to dig out all the crap that I have deposited upon the track here and there so that it's actually possible to run the railroad.
Always a good start.
Right. And then I need to have the discipline to set aside a small segment of the railroad that I'm going to start doing ballasting and stuff like that on, that will only affect that portion of the railroad so that trains can operate on the rest of the railroad.
Mm.
So, but it's going along pretty well. And my client seems to be very pleased with the way things are going. And I'm actively trying to recruit an additional client to get started on a new project, you know, that kind of thing. So
certainly.
There have been people who have actually come to us, to our railroad museum and so forth, in part because of hearing about us through Monorail Radio. So
terrific.
The other thing that I've already commented on online is, it's really quite remarkable how much recognition Monorail Radio has achieved over the past few years as being a truly legitimate part of the conversation about the hobby.
Well, in terms of unique IP addresses, whatever that means, whether that translates to listeners or fractions of listeners, we certainly now have more unique IP addresses hitting the show every month than Model Railroader has subscriptions. So I think we moved past that mark sometime towards the end of last year. And I don't know where it goes from here, because I'm not seeing things slow down. I think when you offer information for, you know, for those that can find it for nothing, for no charge, then it's amazing how many people can actually find you.
Well, yeah, I think that Model Rail Hobbyist is experiencing much of the same, dynamic. Much of the same dynamic. I personally have decided to subscribe to their Trainmasters TV thing, mm-hmm. So they're getting some money from me by that, but. Of course, that's another, you know, that isn't anything that's required to be involved in Model Rail Hobbyist. I'm astonished, quite frankly, at how many people in the local area that I come in contact with through my volunteering at the hobby shop who've never even heard of either Model Rail Hobbyist or Model Rail Radio. You know, I'm giving out this information to everybody left and right.
Very good.
The thing that's a little bit disappointing to me is that I would have expected that when I explain this to people, that they would be excited. And most of the time it's like, eh.
The thing about the hobby is that there have been so many people, I think there's a weariness in the model railroading hobby. People get the expectation that everyone's out to make a swift buck. And if they approach the internet with the same kind of sense that everyone's out to make a swift buck, they may miss out on the, as you say, the vast amount of free information that is available through the internet. I don't know how you turn people around from that. When I started recording podcasts now 7-8 years ago, I used to do like 500 runs of CDs because you can, a CD press at the time, you'd pay between 55 and 75 cents a CD. So I would do 500 runs of CDs and just hand CDs out to people. And I wondered if the same would work with Model Rail Radio, just to pass CDs to people, because most CD players these days will play MP3s. It's a little known fact, but it's actually the case. And certainly all the major computers, if they have CD-ROM drives, they're going to be able to play MP3s.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a good opportunity to get, you know, but the thing is, again, it requires a little bit of motivation. I think.
Well, the other thing is trying to find, which of course is your crown of thorns, is trying to find some relatively compressed, segment or, you know, selection of monorail radio content that could be put on a CD that would be maybe half an hour long that anybody would actually understand and, you know, really get into unless they were already a member of the Klan.
Well, this is interesting. Because what people have done is they've put model... I mean, I know of hobby stores that play model rail radio.
Uh-huh.
And I know of people that do operating sessions that play model rail radio. And
I've tried doing that. I've tried doing that with one of my local model railroad clubs, and nobody really has had any, you know, buy-in to that. But then again, I haven't really been as... insistent, you might say, about people paying attention to what is being played as I might be.
It works very well with layout owners. I mean, I've had interesting feedback from the folks who play it in hobby stores.
Mm-hmm.
But layout owners who play it, typically after, I don't know, after two or three operating sessions, do get positive feedback. And I think the main thing is if the operating sessions are taking, you know, 3-odd hours worth of time, I mean, people are obviously focused and paying attention to whatever they're working on through that period of time. But there's still an opportunity to listen up. And I think what I try to do with model rail radio...
Right. After, out of that 3 hours, you can probably get at least 30 minutes worth of stuff that is coherent and understandable.
Certainly. Hopefully slightly more.
Sorry. Sorry, just poking you in the ribs there about that.
I mean, I try, wherever possible, at least on the regular model rail radio shows, to maintain topics for, you know, 15 minutes to half an hour, but not to have a topic that takes 3 hours of the show.
Hey, I would not be listening to this series the third time. If it weren't for the fact that there is a tremendous amount of high quality stuff to listen to that, you know, unless you are paying rapt attention to the recording all the time, you can't possibly be picking up on all of this information.
Interesting.
Which means that the only way that you can get that information is to listen to it again and again in different at different times in different environments where all of a sudden you'll pay attention to Terry Terrence.
Mm.
Or all of a sudden you'll pay attention to something that Chris Abbott is talking about. Or all of a sudden you'll pay attention to something that Jason Schron is talking about. Or, you know, or Marty McGurk.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he has a whole lot to say that's worth listening to, but,
you can say,
you know, he's better than Lionel Strang, at least.
Certainly. We're in agreement there. But what interests me, I think... There are certain voices that I like. Terry Terrence is just amazing. You hear Terry
he
Terrence
really
does, with
he
some
really
bass.
Does have he has a great he has a great radio voice.
Unbelievable. Yes. So yeah, maybe we just need to do vocal coaching. Maybe we just need to get Marty McGurk. I don't know. I think if Marty McGurk took up pipe smoking or maybe heavy cigar smoking, then you might get that radio voice there. The level of gravel, we need more gravel in Marty McGurk's general content. Anyway, we are digressing here, Peter. We probably need to move on to actual model railroading content, but it's always a pleasure chatting with you, and please, as you do Muse, as you do, I mean, you've been doing it, as you noted recently, with a brass locomotive. Please do keep the documentary evidence flowing associated with the updates that you make.
Tom, you are doing something very important here. And I am really, really grateful that you are continuing to do this. And I know a lot of other people are saying the same thing to you. Please pay attention to all of us. We really do mean it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Tony Ryan, we haven't talked to Tony Ryan in an awfully long time. I do mention his name in vain periodically. Tony Ryan, do you have audio?
Well, I'm here, I think.
So we started the show, or I started the show, I'm not sure if you were on the show initially, but what I was talking about initially was the complete lack of ready-to-run Atlas N-scale track. The fact that the market, I mean, in terms of locomotives and rolling stock, N-scale hasn't slowed down at all. But in terms of the current track shortage, you could probably, you know, make a tidy living creating YouTube tutorials.
Ready to run switches?
Well, no, I wasn't thinking that, actually. Because what it's getting me thinking about, I probably could spend some time with Dave Falkenberg, actually, in the Bay Area, because he seems to be following in your footsteps in terms of the soldering iron and the N-scale track. But you're heavily into N-scale. Has the track shortage been something that's moved you into your recent hand laying, or what got you to the position that you are in currently?
No, I mean, the track shortage hasn't really affected me. I've pretty much stocked up every time I go past the hobby shop. I buy like 10 pieces of flex.
Mm-hmm.
What got me going on the hand laying was just the, well, Tim Morris's website and the fantastic reviews that everybody gave his stuff. And I was actually going to buy one of his jigs, but before I invested $150 or whatever it is for those, I thought, well, I'll just give this a try to see if I can even do it. So that's what got me started on it. And then once I got into it, I was like, wow, it wasn't all that hard, and the results are pretty phenomenal.
Mm.
So that's what got that going.
So for a schmuck such as myself, mm-hmm. who would be considering this.
Do
the,
it.
The soldering iron. I mean, I'm thinking about the investment here. I mean, you have a pretty bare-bones set of tools that you use. But the thing that strikes me is the soldering iron is the first critical purchase here.
Yeah,
because you need a
variable temperature. $7 at... No.
You
no,
don't need a variable temperature.
No. $7... A 25-watt iron from Radio Shack will do the job very good. I mean, the variable temperature is nice because they heat up faster
mm-hmm.
and all of that stuff, but you don't have to have that. You just plug it in, let it get good and hot before you try and use it, and the 795 iron will work just fine. It's get your soldering technique down and... It's kind of like my welding instructor said, you know, you can weld with a coat hanger if you have the right technique.
Mm.
So that's really, it's not expensive. And the rail, that bulk pack of rail, I forget what it was for like $40. And when you price pre-made turnouts at $15 or $20 a piece, $40 for 99 feet of bare rail is a pretty darn smoking deal.
And in terms of the PCB ties?
Well, you can be a cheap bastard like me and make your own. If you want to ruin a perfectly good paper cutter. I bought $70 worth of PCB material. So if you need a sheet, I'll send you some. Or I'll send you some sheared ones.
And you use just a regular rotating blade paper cutter?
No, I use a industrial metal shear because I have access to one at work. But that's that's just because of convenience.
Mm.
But I did a lot of research on it, and a lot of guys just use the regular, not a rotating blade, but you know, like the old school paper cutters with the the big guillotine blade.
Ooh, okay.
Okay, and then just hang on to it and shear it off. And
so how accurate does that get it for N scale, though?
Well, I have a lot of rejects doing it my way, too, because I don't have a stop on the back of the blade.
Mm.
So I'm just going by eye, and I'm shooting for between 55 and 65 to 70 thousandths wide on the ties.
Gosh.
And I'll accept some variation. If you want the precision ties, then I would go with Microengineering sells them, mm-hmm. Fast Track sells them. There's another company that is escaping me, but there's a bunch of companies that sell, you know, ties, PC ties.
Certainly.
And they're not that expensive because you only need, what, maybe 10 PC ties per turnout because they don't all have to be PC ties.
Certainly.
So then you buy some or make the, I usually use the Microengineering basswood ties. But I'm not spiking anything. So I build the skeleton turnout as with all PC ties, and then I slip in the basswood ties once I've got the turnout in place and on the layout and all the feeders run and all that sort of stuff. And I just space them by eye. Some folks like it a little more neat, so they use like the Microengineering jigs or Fast Track quick sticks or something like that. But I'm usually representing rundown branch line trackage, which would be minimal maintenance on it anyway, so I can get away with that look.
And you use a Dremel as well.
I use a Dremel for, I don't use the Dremel anymore for cutting isolation gaps. I use the jewelry saw.
Mm-hmm.
But I have used a Dremel, and I just have the Dremel because I bought it a long time ago for doing just hobby stuff. And because I have it with the flex shaft, it makes it easy to get the cutoff wheel down there and get it pretty square to the rails. But like I showed on my video in the crossing, there's some places that you can't fit a circular cutoff disc in tight enough to get a slot. So the jeweler saw works better for that. I think those are like $20.
Certainly.
So, as far as doing it, I mean, you can do it, I'd say, you know, solder, some good flux, a good set of brushes and files. You'll maybe have $60, $70 in supplies. And I would definitely recommend getting Tim's point form tools.
Mm-hmm.
And his stock aid tools, because that just makes it so much easier.
So in the near term, I am going to be refloating the shelf layout contest. This is the 2014 one. But okay. I am only going to do it associated with the plans, because I think the plan submissions last year indicated to me, in fact, I was overwhelmed by the number of plans that were submitted. I mean, obviously you submitted a few, but there were a number of other folk that submitted plans as well. And I'm going to run the contest again this year, because my plan actually is not to run it as I did last year, but actually probably to produce a little booklet of, I mean, you know, we had 40-odd last year.
Right.
And I think at least 20 of those would merit publication and write-up. I mean, they weren't all exactly, you know, within the spec of the rules and these kind of things, but they were sufficiently interesting.
Yeah, they were very interesting.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sorry I didn't get one in on your garage layout thing.
Is there still time for that layout? I feel almost embarrassed. I probably should look up and see when.
I have one laid out, but it's not a track plan. Mm. It's a bunch. It's showing how a bunch of Freemo modules can fit into that space that you described.
I thought you had more time. Yeah, March 1st. What are we? You've still got 20 odd days.
Well, then maybe I'll send it to you.
Please do.
Okay.
No, unfortunately, my hope with the garage layout contest kind of went a bit awry. I mean, I've put out appeals, I'm putting out more appeals, but the garage space seems to be considerably more, I don't know, technical, for want of a better term. There's a lot more going on than the shelf layouts. And I think the shelf layout contest inspired enough people just to throw down some track and some turnouts, and see how things played together.
Right.
It seems to be just the perfect, you know, the perfect kind of context.
But you think about it. I mean, there's so much you could do with a half a garage.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just sky's the limit.
Certainly.
In fact, I was on a half garage, maybe a whole garage, did my first operating session last weekend.
Oh, and how was that?
Oh, that was a blast. That was my first time ever dealing with car cards and waybills, and I did throw up a YouTube video, but I didn't have time. I thought about strapping my GoPro to my head and wandering around the operating session, but then I thought they'd think I was a real geek.
Yes.
You know, and I don't want train guys thinking I'm a real geek.
Yeah. Where can it go from there?
That's right.
Yeah. So the peanut gallery represented here by Peter Burr has pointed out that I should probably extend the garage layout cutters. My view is with these things, and I'm talking to the audience here as well as to Peter specifically, sometimes it's better just to quit when you're ahead with these things. Award a couple of prizes to the folks that entered and just realize that, because the problem with regards to extending these kind of contests is, firstly, you never actually award prizes. You just keep extending the contest until you feel like you've reached a valued number of entries. But also, for the folks who actually honored the contest rules, my view is that they deserve the rewards, even if there aren't that many of them. So, yeah, I think I'll probably be rounding out the garage layout design contest, awarding a couple of prizes, looking at the entries, and then moving on to the shelf layout design contest for 2014, because sometimes you just got to move on. So, Tony, in terms of your first operating session, can you describe the layout in some detail?
Oh, well, yeah, it's a double-deck, N-scale layout. It's based on the Milwaukee Road Coast Division, so it covers Seattle, Tacoma, Renton, now I can't remember, Black Rock or Black Creek, a few of the other names that I know, and heads east to Chicago through an unspecified yard.
Mm.
Track plan, I can probably draw it. If I really concentrated it, you walk into the garage and there's basically a whole room with 1, 2, 3 yards. Mm-hmm. Two of them are staging yards and one's an active yard. You come out on the lower level, past a Y, around in a big G shape that doubles back on itself. So, and it's kind of like Joe Fugate's, where it's not really a mushroom,
okay,
but it's a half mushroom kind of thing. And so then it doesn't have a helix, but it meanders its way around the outside walls and then out on this peninsula and then turns back on itself and makes one half of a hidden loop to get to the top level and then back around this same convoluted G shape on the upper deck. It was a fun layout. It took probably, I'm guessing, 20 minutes at a decent speed to travel from end to end. And that was my first job, was running two road trains just from one end to the other. And very that nice. Was fun. Yeah.
Very nice. So does it inspire you?
Yeah, it would be nice. I wish I didn't work swing shift, because they asked me to join and come every Monday when they operate. But, you know, got to do the grind.
Certainly. So if there were retirees in your area that did like a morning to early afternoon operating session, is that something you could attend with your swing shift, or is it?
If they were doing morning, I could do it. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Interesting.
That's why I don't join any clubs, is because it's, usually the club guys are Thursday nights, Friday nights, something like that, because that's when normal people are home.
It's interesting, actually. I've got to send my condolences. I mean, I've done this already through the Facebook group, but just for the broader listeners who may not be on Facebook, Jim Gifford's crew suffered a loss recently with the passing of BJ, and BJ had appeared on two recordings of, well, one formal Model Rail Radio and the informal South Australian Takeover show. Jim's crew is of retiring age. I think only one of them still works full-time, and they've moved to morning, early afternoon format for their regular operating sessions. So maybe it's just a matter of finding people who are doing that in your area and seeing if you can, fit in with a crew that is more associated with your work schedule, if possible.
Well, I think what I'm going to concentrate on is the Fremo group. They're coming over here next weekend. We're going to do a mass build for the group and play with my power tools. Hopefully nobody cuts anything off that they didn't mean to. And then March, we're going to have a big setup. And I went to my first ever NMRA meeting also 2 weeks ago.
And how did that go?
It was good. In fact, Ryan Hads, the guy that owns the layout that asked me to come over and operate with him, was given a presentation. And it was held at a Kia dealership over in Oregon. And he's asked us if we have enough guys and have interest in it, we're going to go set up there for a weekend in the half of their showroom. And
wow,
that ought to be fun.
So, gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be cool.
Yeah, in my experience buying cars has only been in this country, has only been in Vegas, and the car dealerships in Vegas like to have a circus atmosphere when people come in to buy cars. But yeah, I think if you had a like a set of modules, like a module layout operating, it seems very highbrow. But I'm just reflecting on Vegas dealerships here when I say that.
Well, he wants to tie it in with a fundraising charity kind of a thing to just get people in there. So it'll be interesting. It'll be worthwhile. And it gives us another thing. Had I known, I think if we would have had our modules ready, the Great American Train Show was a week ago. And some of the guys were, it wasn't our guys, but there was a HO Fremo module. There was two Garden Railroad setups, which was
very nice,
really impressive.
Yes,
two big Lego things, a Z scale modular group, and the Rainier guys, and about 8-9 different layouts that they had. Plus, Dave had his Stevens Pass modular thing. I love his layout, but if we would have been ready, we could have easily got in there and showed off a little bit. That would have been a neat time too. Because they had lots and lots of room for people to set up in.
Well, they're the best kinds of events, aren't they?
Yeah, so we'll keep working at it. We're trying to get more guys, and hopefully if we get more modules, we'll get even more guys. So that'll be fun.
Terrific. Well, keep us up to date, Tony.
We'll do.
With your club and their various exposés. And if you could take your GoPro along to the Kia dealership when you set up, I'd be interested in seeing that.
That I will, because they got a balcony. I can just station it up above and watch us set up. So
you could do like the Benny Hill theme with the setup, you know?
Yeah. Take the time lapse.
Yes. Yes. All right. Good chatting, Tony.
Yeah, good talking to you, Tom.
Like to welcome back on someone who just completely framed the first few years of Model Rail Radio, and then I believe it's probably been at least a year since I last spoke to him. Jason Rice, how are you?
I am good. Busy is all sin, but good. That's usually a good thing when I'm busy. Keeps me out of trouble.
Certainly, certainly. And in terms of your model railroading hobby, I know, I think at least, you've changed jobs recently, potentially, or been promoted or something like that. So your work has changed recently. Am I right in that?
No, actually, haven't done... It's just been... I have finished taking all of my professional architecture exams, which has been 2 years of a lot of studying. So some free time is... been exposed there, but I've exchanged it for doing some mentoring to high school students. So.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
So in terms of your model railroading hobby, what are the interesting updates over the past year?
Over the last year, let's see. Been playing with some 7.5-inch gauge live steam stuff. Mm-hmm. In fact, been working with Peter and his new Form 1 machine. He's been test printing some stuff that I've been modeling in 3D, so that we can have it sent off to be cast. That's actually another benefit of, doing some of this mentoring with, this local high school is that they have, at their school several 3D printers, that they've graciously offered up to, have me show them what can be done with it. In exchange, I get parts. So fair trade. So that's been really interesting. I'm still working on a locomotive that is both battery powered and track powered by the flip of a switch. That has been over a year in the making. I've learned a substantial amount about the electronics that go into it, and we were hoping to be done, except for we've run into a couple of hiccups on the way. I think just about every major component in it has been replaced at least once.
Mm-hmm.
Which is true for, you know, any good project that you try for the very first time.
Certainly.
But our biggest one is we found out, or we just heard back from LockSound that this is for a Shea, that the decoder that is programmed with the Shea sounds, they disable intentionally the cam action on it, which was one of the things that we were wiring up, and I couldn't figure out for the life of me for 3 months why I couldn't get it to work. I ordered a new one, waited. The new one didn't work. Finally, I sent it back and said, something's up. Mm. What is? And they just got back to me about a week and a half ago saying, yeah, it doesn't work. We turned it off. So a bit of a hair puller for that one. But hopefully button that one, that project up here in the next month. Outside of that, we hosted our Railroad Club dinner last week. That went off well. Did dinner and drinks and game and prizes at a local restaurant. I think a lot of people have commented it was our best dinner to date, so that was a good sign. Now we just need to, as always, garner new members and push forward. But we've done a lot of scenery on the layout. We're now pretty much working the layout out to operational point, adding in a few pieces of track here and there, maybe turning a switch to get it to operate properly, so that as we're finishing up scenery, that we can move into operations right away. So, but as far as my railroading goes, that's been it. Unfortunately, there just hasn't been a lot of time put aside for it. So
yes. So can we talk a little bit about, because you took some photographs associated with your club, again, I'm thinking probably a year or so ago. So sure. You now have the track laid, and you've got most of the scenery in, and it looked like it was like designed for operation. Can you talk a little bit about the process from kind of getting the wood, putting the wood in, how much planning went into that, and now you're moving through it progressively? Can you talk about some of the incremental steps that you went through as a club?
Keep in mind, this has been going on for several years. This started back in 2003.
Okay. But I thought there was something new. The photos that you posted seem to indicate that as a club you've existed since 2003, but the actual wood and stuff, the latest iteration of the layout is still relatively recent, or am I completely off base there?
Well, it depends. The original way the layout was designed is, back when the club moved to its current location, we sat down and we designed basically a loop with a couple, you know, we knew where the yard was going to be, we knew where some passing sightings were, and that the idea was as it developed, we would determine industry. It wasn't, we planned it all out in advance, and we didn't lay anything until we had it all planned. It was actually a designed by Genesis kind of concept. We will build it, we'll run it in circles until we get bored with that, and then we start throwing in, this would look, what would look really nice here? How about we try this? And there's been a couple of areas where we really have. We've tried three or four, five things, and it hasn't felt right. And I think we're getting now to the last part of that. One of the biggest additions overall to the layout was just off of the yard. We added a large peninsula that was a engine servicing facility for the railroad. We've also added in some industry spurs throughout the layout. One of the things we're adding now is helper service and an interchange railroad and an oil spur in a place where some of the locomotives actually do physically need help to get up our 2.5% grade, which is pretty steep.
Mm.
So it made sense to kind of add that in, but what else can we add in? I mean, this is on basically a 3/4 loop great. So how do we fill in? This is also the place that we've had to tear out scenery several times. So how do we fill in this space with a job to do for the river? Mm. Why did it go through here? Was it, you know, is it servicing something or is it just a bit of track? And so we're adding in two legs of to an oil facility and an interchange that just, it's literally just a, you know, half curve of track that comes up from a perpendicular piece of flex track that just runs either side of the balloon. It doesn't go anywhere. There will never be trains on it. But it kind of gives the idea that there's more, that the layout just isn't a self-contained world, that, you know, there's something beyond the edge of the fascia. One of the other things one of the other members is doing is we've sat and talked about, we had a two-car cattle track that really didn't make much sense the way it was and in the direction that it was. So we've since tore it out and turned it around and extended it. So now it'll be have about four cars of loading for different kind of livestock cars, both bi-level and single-level livestock, which, you know, it's on the edge of the layout again, we don't have to model a whole bunch of livestock, but and the pens and everything, but it'll give us something to deliver cars to and take them from, and, which, you know, livestock if done right, is a very interesting industry in and of itself, given how the railroad has to maintain the livestock and how many hours in between having to service them, get them off, get them water and fed, all that kind of stuff. So from the club wise, that's how we've always managed it. And now we're, like I said, we're mounting on waybill boxes and that kind of stuff along the side of the layout. And we have one member who is going through all the cars and starting to write up all the car cards and waybills for them. So.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, if you get a chance, please do update the photographs.
Sure. I know we have a Facebook group, so if anybody wants to join, it's the Raccoon Valley Model Railroad group. Just let me know. We pretty much let anybody join, but we do keep it as a closed group, just for keeping the riffraff out, though I'm in it, so are all the other members. So
yes, yes.
But no, it's good, and I'll. I know we've had our O scale guys have been doing some hard at work stuff too. In fact, one of the members who is does a lot of the ON3 stuff has talked about doing a massive change on their layout. So we'll see what comes of that in the future.
Very good, Jason. Well, it's a pleasure catching up.
As always, Tom. Thank you.
Take care. I'd like to welcome on Fred Van Dorp. Fred, as this is your first time on Model Rail Radio, would you like to introduce your model railroading interest?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I've never done this before. I didn't know anything about it, but thank you very much. I live in Chicago, Illinois. I'm 19 and a half. I've never moved anywhere. I've lived here my whole life, and Chicago is the railroad capital of the world for the most part. Very busy, for the United States, all six class 1-6 railroads go through it. In model railroading, of course, we're getting to that. I've actually got my first O-scale model railroad, train set. It was a MTH, it was some Fairbanks Morris Trainmaster diesel from MTH, O-scale. I got some Lionel track, a Lionel type KW transformer, and that was 190 watts, I think. Mm-hmm. And the ZW was 275, and other details about that too, being the highest wattage transformer ever made for a O scale.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, in the years to come, I got over to HO scale. I realized that it'd be more modeling possibilities and more fitting, better, more reasons here and there for every preference, of course. Depends on the person. Do I like N scale? Do I like O scale? You know, money, what do you have? You know, all different types of variations of what can actually fit per person.
In terms of HO, what do you model specifically?
I actually started out with smaller stuff, you know, just the cheaper stuff. I was younger. Mm-hmm. And I finally got going to a hobby shop near my house. and I started realizing and seeing the stuff in a higher quality at your Walder's overall and different stuff. And I wanted to, you know, I went to the Model Railroad Club also near my house, and I saw they had these trains that had sound in them and the digital controller. And I just had the DC pack with back and forth and simplistic stuff. And I was like, that's so cool, you know? So I thought, I'll save up some money, you know? It just, I got into it. And as I got into it more and more, I got more and more into steel trains. Mm-hmm. The era I'm in into is the first trains I got for DCC and sound were two Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy, EMD F7, an A and a B unit, number 168A mm-hmm. and 168B from Waller's Pro 2000. They have QSI sound, and it's an older version. People have said, hey, it's not prototypical sound. Some people, they're just fine with it, you know? And that's a huge decoder thing and electric stuff. Mm-hmm. It's all preference. And actually, I've heard that 168 A, B, and C are the last F7s for the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy to have on their roster before being scrapped or retired, for what I've known. And then I got into... let's see here. The next model I got, I think I have a Metro train, you know, because it's Chicago. Why not mm-hmm. have an RTA or Metro train? That's
certainly.
So I have a lot of stuff in the 50s, covered wagons, early hood, EMD hood units, and the mass-produced Jeep 7s or F units or even E units too. And I've got a few modern locomotives too, because why not go without that? And as you know, I'm 19, so mm-hmm. I'm not the guy to have all the money to see something, oh, that's cool, that would match with that, and just buy it, because, you know, I'm 19. I gotta work my way up there, of course.
Certainly. So do you have a layout?
No, I have worked on it here and there. I'm 19, so I actually, Chicago has a lot of rail action, so a lot of time I will spend going here and here on the Metro train, and just taking photos and videos of a lot of different, rail trains, of course, so rail fanning as well. So sometimes, a lot of times I'll find myself where I just don't have the time to go around the house or go to different hobby shops all the time and spend the hours and hours working here and there. And plus I'm 19, so I'm still learning on all the craftsmanship and the scenery and the modeling and stuff. And right now I'd say I'm pretty much covered for electrical mm-hmm. and DCC stuff, but it's a learning process, and you can never, as a lot of things that I've said, you can never stop learning about model railroading and trains.
So in terms of your area, I mean, we have on a number of folk. I think we have a couple of Chicagoland folk on. We've got Terry Gaskin, who models three rail, but does the, what's it called? The passenger.
CTA.
Everyone's screaming in the chat. CTA. We have a number of folks who are in your area actually tonight. In terms of people that you, I mean, do you go to other people's layouts? Is your hobby social in that regard?
I don't, I'm not a member of the NMRA.
Mm-hmm.
I am a member of the Illinois Rail Museum, so that's a real thing. But mm-hmm. I know we'll stick to model trains for the meantime, because when it comes to real trains, I love talking about the real stuff and all that, but we'll stick to model trains because that's the topic.
Fair enough.
I actually don't visit, you know, people's personal layouts. I mean, that's kind of an NMRA thing, so people get to go to the NMRA local, or the division meetings stuff, and they get to know each other, mm-hmm. and there's operating sessions here and there. And since I'm not a member, I really can't be doing that, like I just at will and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know some people, for the guys in Chicagoland, I am a member of the Garfield Clarendon Model Rare Club, and just search it up on Google or whatnot, and it's near Montrose Harbor on the north side. And it's the layout, the location's been there since 1974, and I've been there a member for maybe a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
And I started visiting there when I was a bit younger as well, but since of the younger members and liability or whatnot, the rules, you know, junior totally. Membership, yes. So I became a member when I turned 18, so about over a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what does that club do? Does that have a club layout, or is that just a collection of guys?
It's one of the nicer layouts that I've actually been to and since I first visited. And since it's only a few miles from my house, and the membership fees are actually very nice. We got about 30 members,
mm-hmm.
and the whole layout is all hand-laid HO skill track, code 83, code 70, the mixes of here and there.
Certainly.
We are NCE DCC. We don't have any DC, so it's not dual DC and DCC. You've got to have a DCC decoder equipped model train to run there. As for membership, it's $9 a month, and then I think it's $3 for younger membership. But for the $9 a month, it's, and the layout is actually very good. We have a working signal system, but it runs the switches. They're all switches are Tortoise machines, mm-hmm. but we have buttons that use the tortoises, and that's all run by DC power packs located here and there.
Terrific.
Since I'm more of the computer guy and a lot of that stuff, I wanted to get the layout slowly converted maybe over the years to Decoder Pro and JMRI, so it can operate. Maybe if we do install decoder switch decoders for every switch, we could do it via computer and then a map and operate whatnot from Decoder Pro, which can do many, many things with a DCC layout and other type things. The layout also, it's all hand laid track. We have one of those Walder's 130-foot turntables. Mm. We're working on making it work, not lose programming every time to shut the layout down, so we can keep that to its, we can keep it to its own power, or when there's a short, actually, there's a short out, then, we have four power packs, and we added a fifth power pack, to keep that from shorting for it separately for that self. So if there is a short and the current does temporarily get cut to the turntable, circuitry, it won't lose its programming for whatever reason. The signals, they work for the most part. They're in good places. It's a good layout. We have good members that have been there for many, many years. They're very knowledgeable with all the trains, this and that. It's very nice. I actually, when I first went there, I was maybe 14 or 15, mm-hmm. something like that. And I met a friend there who was actually going there just like me. He was young. He's 18. And since I think it was after eighth grade. So 2008. Yeah. So about that, 2009. We've been friends for over 5 years now, and we go whale fanning. We go to the club almost every week on Friday nights. It's near Montrose Harbor, in Clarendon Park. You can search it up on Google. It's a pretty easy find. The website, is Garfield Central or Club. Just type into Google. You'll get all the information. However, it's open every Friday evening from about 4 to 5-ish. It depends when a member with a key to turn the layout on gets there. And we go to about 10 in the winter, mid-fall to mid-spring. It's till 10 p.m. in the evening on Friday. And then in the spring to mid-fall, it's open till 9. So pretty much all summer. Mm. And that's the clubhouse, because we're under the Chicago Park District building. So therefore, we have to be there when they're open, or, you know, we can't just hold the whole building open for ourselves. So, and that includes if there's holidays, we can't have our club open because the whole building isn't open. We have Wednesdays where we stay till 7. Some of the guys want to go out for a drink or two, you know, and I'm not that kind of guy. I just go home after that. I'm only 19. That's mainly a work night, but it's actually a growing club since it's slightly over time. It's actually, very quality. I like it. Mm-hmm. We have open houses. Surprisingly, a few months ago, this is very interesting. This is the busiest this club has ever got. Mm. We had some, I don't know, maybe some of you know about the Chicago Architectural Foundation. Mm. I'm not sure how it works either, but it's something to do with the old architectural stuff around Chicagoland, because there can be a lot of stuff given. It's a big city with old buildings and stuff. And part of there is some open house where, I guess every year, the Art Foundation has the certain locations where people volunteer to open whatever, you know, architectural museum or whatever is open. We were part of the building that we're in is, I guess, part of that for something. And we volunteered to, and they wanted our club. They looked at our club and said, we want to put this in our feature list on our whatever flyer or something. And we vowed to have Saturday and Sunday, just one weekend from about 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. So 6 hours each day. The first day, we had over 700 visitors. And the second day on Sunday, we had another 700. There was, I think, a total count of 1,450 visitors about that. Cool. But, I mean, over 1,000 visitors in one weekend for a club that actually isn't really, really a very big club, because it's more of a mountainous layout where we have a loop around and stuff. it was packed to the point where sometimes you couldn't follow your train where it was going, and you had to stop to catch up with the train, not the train to catch up to you.
So I'm looking at the website. We had a Tony Ryan post to the website, and I'm just looking. It's a beautiful club. This is a club that was started in, like, the late 1940s, and I'm not sure if it's from the same location. But just amazing hand-laid track, and just, I mean, for someone such as yourself, who's getting into the hobby, or not necessarily getting into the hobby, but kind of maturing your level of modeling, this is an amazing club to be working on. Just phenomenal. Phenomenal stuff.
And there's other clubs such as Elmhurst Model Railroad Club, which I do visit since I have some friends there. You know, we're hand in hand. We're two completely different clubs, of course, but there's some members that know us and there's some members stuff. And the Elmhurst Model Railroad Club, I'm not a member. Their membership is $20 a month. So, and I'm paying $9 a month and foreclosed to my house. You know, it's pretty much a better deal. Since I know I have very good friends with some other guys, I get to run there every so often at Elmhurst because it's fairly busy at all. And that club used to be in Bensonville, known as White Pines Club. And that was a humongous club until the storage building or something where they had their lease or rent expired and they had to move. And there's, and in other clubs around Chicagoland, there's one in Lombard, I think, near a very good hobby shop, a very well-known hobby shop near Lombard Hobbies. The club is, I don't remember the name of it, but the membership is insane. It's pretty high per month. And, you know, per club, it's all what people, set down as rules. And our club is a bit more loose and stuff. And since we've had the, we just kept the layout for some time. And, I mean, it really wasn't ever a busy layout. And maybe not very well known, but the track is in good condition. There's a member at our club who's also a member at Elmhurst, and he's been doing it for quite a long time. And he's got a lot of model trains as well on HO scale. And he will say he notably knows that our club doesn't see as many derailments and better quality, running and everything for the trains than at Elmhurst. And at Elmhurst, they have, flux track that they use, and, it's a lot more track and a lot more space, but one of the friends that I know, who is a member there, who used to be White Pines, he's been doing it for a very long time. He replaces the track at Elmhurst every so often, and there's so many trains, so many members that sometimes it's just not possible. So he'll go down there by himself. And he said one time on a single track block, he replaced track that the whole head of the rail was gone because there were so many trains in Elmhurst being run. So they were running on the thin part of the rail as if in real life, the whole head was gone. And that means that it's very busy. So given that our club has custom laid track, and I guess over the years before the guys went, in the 80s when they did the stuff and all that, they did a very good job with it. And since this last 2014, that shows that it's a very good quality stuff and everything. Also, NCE though, their Digitracks can be expanded and with the hardware and stuff can be more, reliable in a way, but. Mm-hmm. Since we converted to DC, I think it was about 2000. I wasn't around, of course, then to know about this, but they said something about that. And, we ripped out all the DC wiring and stuff. And there's still a lot of wiring underneath it that's maybe not used or is not necessary. We're to the point where we could rip out everything to the track feeders and we could redo it with DCC and make it a lot more simpler. And well, more, better, easier to do stuff. And we have reversing blocks. It's a two track. So one direction, the other direction. And when you turn around, it's a reversing block. And recently, there's been problems with the reversing blocks. Every time it reverses, it quickly shorts out the locomotives. Sometimes there might be a deconsist. Sometimes it'll be on the wrong spot on a switch where it'll keep shorting until you give it a nudge. Sometimes, it can trigger certain things. And there's been various problems here and there that we've tried to fix. We're going about that as best we can. But given that with DCC and you have a reversing block, there could be problems here and there with the wiring, especially when we ripped it all out and put DCC in and we still got some existing DC wiring that we haven't really been able to go through underneath the layout all over and, completely sort it all out and get it fixed. So it's not completely solved. But it's still the whole layout. You can run a train on very nicely. I have some videos on YouTube and on my laptop that I've taken of some that I haven't posted yet of some trains here and there. I think there's, I'm sure all of you or many of you are in the very big model railroading group on Facebook. It has over 3,000 members or so. Mm-hmm. There was some photo contest, I think, and I posted a picture of a Milwaukee Road Hiawatha, with an E7 and an F7. And then there was a Milwaukee Road SD9 that wasn't very visible, taking a Siouxland caboose bet that I said was taken coming back from a local. And, it was a pretty good photo. We do advancements here and there. We could say it's not more quantity. It's more quality of a layout.
Certainly. Yes.
And that's one thing that also does matter, because even without quantity and quality of a layout with the good scenery and all the details intricately placed in every certain spot, it doesn't need to be run your train and get it on the layout have your train do a full loop in a half an hour. It could be maybe 15 minutes. But you could still enjoy going slowly, and some of them like doing that.
Yes. No, it's an amazing layout. I mean, I would certainly recommend folks go to the website, which is garfieldcentral.org. Yeah.
Yeah. The website, actually, we've been in the meetings every month. It's the first Friday of every month. Mm-hmm. Second and third is usually work night, but, we have to have some people run. Sometimes we work. It all depends, of course, who's there and who's not. And then last Friday of each month is a running night. And we'll have open houses. I think we'll post it around. We have flyers at hobby shops. There's a hobby shop in Edgebrook, Greenland Station. There's one in Des Plaines. There's one in Lombard. Mm. There's one in Hearst. There's different runs. We'll put out flyers here and there. Mm-hmm. One of the things that with the website, we're trying to update it since the old domain server or provider that we've had is charging too much. And one of our guys is trying to convert it over to some Google app thing where it'll cost much less to have the same domain name. And one of the problems I'm guessing that he's having is trying to keep that exact same domain, garfieldcentral.org, but actually transfer the website coding and all that to Google for whatever, so Google can host it or whatever. I'm not so knowledgeable about the internet stuff. Mm-hmm. However, though, I would recommend going there and look up Elmhurst Model Railroad Club. Also, there's some clubs even farther than from Chicagoland. There's one in South Elgin, near Elgin. It's called Valley Model Railroad Club. There's one in Chadwick, Illinois. That's way far west. That's about 20 minutes from Mississippi. I was there. It's a very small town. There's not even a gas station in that town. But the BNSF Aurora sub, gets the slowest speed of a train that goes by across the street from that club, since the building itself is a club itself. The train's the slowest, there's BNSF, it's high speed. The slowest they ever go is 50 miles an hour. And sometimes there will be train after train after train, and the guys that they're members there, they'll sleep there overnight and they'll be woken up by every train because there's horn. They blow the horn at that crossing right across from the club. The Chicagoland area is very good for anything trains, really, because, I mean, you're talking, all six of the class one railroads or the major ones, Norfolk Southern, CSX, CP, CN, UP, and BNSF. And then you've also got some other railroads that are, gone already or been merged into other railroads or bought, but then there's still remnants here and there of them. For example, EJ&E, the around Chicago, not through railroad. That's a very famous one. And, locomotives being repainted by CN. Illinois Central, that's slowly dying away with its paints here and there on their locomotives. Wisconsin and Southern, that got recently bought by, Watco. Mm-hmm. And they have some locomotives that are already being the reporting marks are already be changed to WAMX. And as we know, the WSOR, even their two locomotives, or 4030, the 30th anniversary is on heritageunits.com where you can track certain locomotives. Mm-hmm. It's an update. And since Watco bought it, whenever it does happen, all those locomotives will be repainted here and there and will be in Watco. And the 30 years of Wisconsin Southern, the predecessor was, or to Wisconsin Central, it's just gone, and Wisconsin Southern was a very great railroad. And given that Watco bought it, a lot of the rail fans in Wisconsin, Chicago just disliked that, as well as CN taking over, Illinois Central, EJ&E, even BC Rail, some Chicagoland rail fans like BC Rail, surprisingly that it's in Canada,
Certainly. Well, Fred, we have, like I said, we have a few Chicagoland folk in the chat. Terry Gaskin, do you have audio? Terry, how are you? I'm very well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to chat. We have Fred on. He's a local to you. He's throwing out a number of clubs, a number of names. Mike Slater knows some of the people in some of those clubs as well. What would you like to add to Fred's general discussion?
Fred's doing a great job. He's really covered all the bases of the clubs. And I knew about that Clarendon Park Club when I was in college. I went to Loyola and Rogers Park in the late 80s, early 90s, and I wanted to join the club. I just never had a chance to, so I kind of wish I did now because I lived in that area for years. So, you know, I knew it was there. I just never was able to get over there. But, yeah, it's nice that we have all these clubs and the hobby shops, so it's nice to have. And it's a shame. I can't think of – somebody will have to remind me. There was a club in Geneva, Illinois. It was like the Midwest Model Railroad Club that was just one of the best layouts I've ever seen. They were in a couple of issues of Model Railroader, and that was just a phenomenal club. I think a couple of alumni from that are famous modelers. Now I can't think of their names, of course, but it's too late. But, no, he's really covered, and that's fantastic that you get, you know, being, you know, young like that and having all the enthusiasm to, you know, carry on the hobby. So obviously, as everybody says, the hobby is not dying. So that's a great thing to have.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if I can add to this too, I'm sure many of you have heard about JLWII 2000 on YouTube, and he does HO scale model train reviews of, you know, new things coming out or comparisons of older releases of the same engine to the newer stuff. And at Train Fest last year in November, so maybe 2 or 3 months ago, he was in Milwaukee for Train Fest. Totally. And I got to meet him, and I showed up in his video of the Milwaukee Train Fest, of course, same name. And, in my channel, I named my channel, on YouTube. I do a lot of rail fanning things, and I also try to include as many model train things as well. I've been pretty busy lately and not been able to go out a lot because of, well, this is one of the most notable coldest and snowy winters in Chicagoland ever.
Yes.
Even my, you know, guys at the club that I know who aren't even my age, you know, they're 40, 50, maybe 30, you know, they're older than me, they're adults, and they slipped more than they've said they slipped more notably than other winters, definitely. But I mean, the I know him, and Dave Hawley, and many of you probably don't know this. He worked for the CNW, and then he, you know, UP bought CNW, and he works as a locomotive hostler. He moves the real locomotives around in Global 3 in Rochelle, so on the Geneva sub. And that's where that junction is by BNSF Aurora and the UP Geneva sub. And I was there a few weeks ago. I stayed at Dave's house for 4 nights. Oh, there's Mike Slater. I know him on Facebook. I've seen his name in my suggestion list.
Pretty good.
Yeah, there we go. There's another guy from Chicago I know or have heard the name of. Hey, Mike. But anyways, Dave Hawley, I stayed at his house for 4 nights, and it was a very great time. And it was raining and melting the snow, and the bottom of the parking lot was a pond and full of slush. So I slipped once, even myself, as my athletic person as I am. And I could, even when the train gates went down outside the building there, it's maybe less than 50 feet away, and I couldn't get out fast enough to get a desirable shot from a certain angle for a locomotive or a train coming through. But he has talked to me, and I've explained things to him, and this is a huge problem occurring in the Chicagoland area from what I've heard. And there is this a newer rail fan, and he doesn't do model trains, of course. I've never met him, but he visits Rochelle, and Dave lives in Rochelle and works in Rochelle. He's been doing it for a very long time. And I don't want to give the kid's name away because he's 14. He lives in Sandwich, so his grandmother drives him up so often to rail fan at Rochelle because he likes trains, and he lives right next to the Mendota sub. So, you know, given that he's young, he's new, just like I was 5 years ago. No big deal. You know, I can understand. And Dave took a picture with the 14-year-old friend and said, "This is my new friend." And Dave is very well known as a railroad guy. He does the Rochelle Railroad Days and brings in a heritage unit or two that for the days. And this year I'm going to go visit him and help him out with the display and stuff. But I'm like, oh, a new rail fan came just when I left Rochelle after staying with Dave first. So I, you know, friended the 14-year-old, friend on Facebook and talked to him. And, you know, I could see that he liked trains and he was very enthusiastic. But he had some issues, and I was wondering why Dave had posted a picture with him, because that's not, you know, common. Oh, Dave just can post a picture with some brand new friend. Mm-hmm. So I asked Dave, and Dave and me talk a lot, and we're good friends. And Dave said that the kid, you know, 14-year-old, he was getting picked on by the other rail fans. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, these other guys, whatever he's saying, they're not being nice. And mm-hmm. so Nick says, Freddie, help me. And you know, it does, as logical as it sounds, he let me onto his Facebook, and I'm honest with that. I'm not going to do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm, and in his messages, there's other rail fans, which I will not give out names to either, mm-hmm. but they are picking on him, saying he's a bad rail fan, and to words and stuff that are just very wrong, and this and that, just very inappropriate content. Mm-hmm. And he's 14 years old, and he should not be being picked on, regardless of his likes or views on trains, no matter where it is in trains.
Certainly.
All right. And he's getting picked on, and these other rail fans that I've tried or known on Facebook, I'm like, they've also picked on me. These guys I didn't really like either. And since I'm, you know, I understand more, okay, they pick on me, just block them, you know, let them do what they want and mm-hmm. let them, you know, hurt themselves over time. So, but you know, he's 14. So maybe he doesn't know any better, doesn't understand. Like I was at 14, I wouldn't know how to deal with it. And these other guys are 18, 17, maybe even 15, you know, and they're picking on my 14-year-old friend. And it's very disturbing. And I'm looking at the, you know, Facebook groups and stuff, and over 1,000 messages over a day or two or three. And I'm just like, I gotta help this guy, you know, help him. And the content was so bad that I could report it to the police, and it could go, and then whatever has to go from there. Yeah. You know, these guys could get in trouble for what's known as a cyberbullying felony crime. And it is true that, you know, over recent years, that kids over the years, wherever in the world, mm-hmm. they will commit, take their own life.
I know.
Or,
you know, it is a troubling problem. Yeah, it is a difficult community because you're right. There's a mix of people who are genuinely children and people who are adults. And I think I'm certainly very mindful of, you know, running a model rail related Facebook group, that a majority of the folk that are there are, you know, very friendly and very knowledgeable. Rail fanning is a distinctly different community, and I think you were going to go in that direction because I was talking about model railroaders.
Yeah, I was going to tie it into your things, is that mm-hmm. these other rail fans, they also do model trains too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know them personally, I don't know their layouts and stuff, but as I was saying, JLWIR2000 on mm-hmm. YouTube, he recently posted a video of cyberbullying in the model railroading and rail fanning communities, and that's exactly the title, I think, on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And he talked to Dave and me, and he, you know, saw a post on Facebook and stuff saying, you know, hey, what's going on? And Dave, and actually James did have it in his lineup of videos to post, but he posted it early because of hearing from me and Dave and other, I guess, stories from his view. Certainly. And there has been a lot of action on that video and commentary from people saying, you know, why is this happening? We all like trains.
Exactly.
Why are we picking on each other? We all share the same interests. Is this World War II again? You know, like, come on.
So you seem to be mentioning that most of the cyberbullying is actually between people that are like 15, 16, 17. It's not adults.
Maybe
yet.
The younger years as well.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say that's comparable to adults maybe being a bit more used to the hobby and not understanding younger guys getting into it, and they just don't mix very well at certain mm-hmm. times. But I mean, I would be certain though is that, you know, if you see a rail fan or Ronald Railroader doing something, you know, wrong, be mature about it. If mm-hmm. they don't want to cooperate or anything, just be careful and stuff. Because I've talked to some other guys who have been around the United States, and they say this doesn't happen in all the places they know of. It's pretty much only in this area. Now they can't confirm that for sure, because it could be in any place, any time, mm-hmm. even in a small town, but wherever model railroaders may be in the world, mm-hmm. Model railroading is, you know, is the most, well, I guess you could call, I guess a train say it, the most popular hobby or in the world. I don't know how to say it exactly, but it's the, you know, it's the most popular hobby to do and stuff, and world's best hobby, or however you say it, mm-hmm. and you know, and with that, as it gets more popular, with more popularity, gets more, you know, people on each other and whatnot. So
certainly,
yeah, I mean, it was just something I wanted to bring up and make aware. Of course,
I think it's certainly a very valid point. I do want to talk a little bit about, you call him James, we call him Jim Wright. He's been on the show previously. We've had a chance to chat with him. The stuff that he's doing on YouTube is phenomenal. But you mentioned that you had a YouTube channel as well.
Yes.
What's the YouTube channel?
RailroadFan5383. One, all lowercase besides the first letter, and 5383 is after the Burlington Northern U30C, General Electric U30C, at the Old Marine Museum, because many years ago I got a cab ride on it, and it was during the Diesel Day event, and we were doing a load simulation where the U30C was pulling the C&W 6847 ST4-2 in dynamic. It's a load simulation, so pretty much the ST4-2 is acting like the rest of a train, pretty much. And they're not MU'd. It's a pretty cool effect, because you see one engine smoking up like crazy, and the other one is actually having its dynamics blowing away. But, you know, I named it after that. But in all honesty, my favorite railroads are Chicago Northwestern. That's got to be number one. And then second or third, Burlington Northern and Milwaukee Road. And I mean, the reason being is because they're Chicago Railroad. They're based out of Chicago. You know, they're all on the north side. I live close to the north side, and I've always been around the north side for my life, you know, and I really like those railroads. And, you know, tying in the model railroading, I actually like doing decoder installs and stuff, and I'm learning more about that. And decal weathering and stuff like that. No, I'm not into that yet, but I have some friends here and there that are actually my age, and they're actually very good at it themselves as well. So you can almost say that with my, you know, some friends of mine that are good friends of mine, they're good at this part of model railroading, and I'm good at that part. And then the R's are just like trains overall in general, you know, they may not be the most talented in doing custom doing stuff or whatnot, you know? And in all honesty, I don't know why, but I almost think of me learning about trains as a job sometimes, because it takes so much time. I've legitimately gone on the internet and look up this kind of locomotive and just read all about it and all these information and statistics and or what railroad had that order or that or whatnot. And another reason why I kind of learned so much, even though I'm 19 and a half, I learn a lot about that stuff. And sometimes I will talk to older guys, and they will be, whoa, how does he know this much? And, you know, I mean, maybe it's because maybe the older guys got into it later, or I don't know. But, you know, like in my dream, I want to work for the railroad, and I love trains, and it's almost like, you know, you're addicted to it. You can't ever get out of trains. And that's almost how I feel like it. It's just like, I don't think I could ever quit doing trains overall and get into something else, such as video games or whatnot, you know?
Certainly. Fred, I feel obligated to introduce you to Mike Slater on this call, because I think you have some familiar interest. Mike Slater, do you have audio?
Yes, I do.
Well, I'd like to introduce you to Fred. He seems to have similar interests to you on some level.
Tom, give the guy a break. Give the kid a break. He's just starting out in the hobby. Come on.
What do you mean?
Mike, I mean, come on.
What, do you think Mike's too extreme?
No, Mike.
Maybe, I don't know. But then again, I have seen on my Facebook Mike Slater as a mutual friend, or want to add this. And I actually have seen Mike, so maybe I'll do that right now.
Fred,
that's going to be talking him into three rail O scale stuff.
Fred, I'm kidding. Mike is a great guy.
Mike is a great guy. Ignore this Lionel Strang character.
Lionel's the one you got to worry about.
Let's talk to Mike for a minute here, because this phenomena associated with cyberbullying and rail fanning circles in your area, Mike, were you aware that this was an issue?
Well, I actually know of his friend in Sandwich. I actually had friended him on Facebook and actually unfriended him within the same evening. And it was just, I really don't want to go into details. And it's something I could talk to.
With me personally.
With you personally and that.
I can explain to you some things here and there. Yeah. You would understand.
Yeah. You know, within my own circle of rail fanning friends, which Tom has met one of them in Grand Rapids, and my one friend does have a mental disability, and you know, we joke, you know, with each other. You know, it's not picking on or you know, it's just like with any other group of friends. You know, you just joke around with each other, and sometimes maybe an outsider of the group may see a group of people joking around, but It's something that, unfortunately, you do have in a lot of different circles. It's just not railroading or trains.
Someone posted, I think it was you, Mike Slater, posted the recent Big Bang episode associated with the guy who had a box fall on his head when he worked at FedEx. There's this perception associated with the modern railroading hobby, and certainly your friend who I met, Mike, I think there's an intensity associated with people that are into trains. Where, I know people that have Asperger's and various other disorders that, you know, are perfectly functional, but do have particular proclivities. And I think the model railroading hobby is so inclusive, and I think it's one of the wonderful things about the hobby. I mean, we've talked in a previously deleted section associated with a group of model railroaders that I've been introduced to that I never would have had exposure to anyway, and my immediate reaction was, this is a wonderful thing. I mean, if there's something to be said, I don't know about the broad rail fanning hobby. The rail fans that have befriended me on Facebook, I think, can be a bit rough around the edges, typically.
Yes, absolutely, and that's why I've blocked about 30-plus people, honestly. Yes.
Particularly around the elections, it gets a little interesting with the rail fan community. But moving on from that, I mean, I think it's an interesting hobby because, in general, I think it's extremely inclusive of a wide variety of folk. I mean, you've got basically every extreme in this hobby. I mean, just in terms of political ideologies and, you know, a wide variety of things. It is a very inclusive hobby because, as Fred has noted, once you have the fixation on something associated with trains, it's a pretty tough bug to shake.
Yeah. It's almost like, well, you know, it's almost like smoking, you know, it's very hard to get rid of. And I know that it's a bad thing. And given that I'm 19, there are very many people who will, you know, do drugs, smoking, alcohol, and they just don't get rid of it. And I'm 19. I grew up in the North Side. I'm not a bad character. I avowed to myself, not even like to anyone or my parents, I'm not going to ever smoke. I'm not going to ever do drugs or any alcohol. And I actually don't like taste alcohol. And that's a good thing. And given that I'm into trains, it almost makes up for doing those things and making myself feel good or whatnot, you know?
No, I think, I mean, it's a phenomenal hobby. And for those of us that are married, I think our spouses tend to understand that it's probably better that we're not alcoholic womanizers.
I'll leave a little questioning thing here. If, you know, those who are married and actually are in trains and your spouse is accepted, think about the problem with me. Because I'm 19.
Well, I don't think that's... I mean, it's interesting, actually, because we followed a fellow who was, when he started calling into the show, was younger than you, and he's found... I mean, actually, it's really interesting following, you know, young model railroaders, because they do end up... I mean, you know, they do end up dating and things like that. It's not an eliminating hobby with regards to these kind of things at all. In fact, oftentimes people talk about the time where they put down the hobby is, you know, when they actually, you know, get married, what have you. So I don't think it's an eliminating hobby necessarily in that light, Fred.
But then again, it's definitely not something to say, go up to a girl or whoever and say, hey, do you like trains or want to talk? And then they're just like, they don't even know what to say, you know?
Well, I've been following a fellow who posted recently, who I think is 20, and he's found a girl whose father is a model railroader. And she's, like, sympathetic, let's say. You see, I spent my life, my thing is computers. If I can give any sage advice, when I was started working with computers, I was in my early teens, basically. I'd been programming. And my family thought that it meant that I would never get married. I had no interest in women, you know, all this kind of thing. Prove people wrong, Fred. Don't assume because you're interested in trains that don't rely on any misnomer associated with model railroading and these kind of things.
True.
Just let it happen. Fred, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. And what I'm going to ask you is I would like you to call back on a periodic basis and give us updates and let us know the stuff that you're discovering. And there's a phenomenon associated with model rail radio. We go out to quite a few listeners, and no doubt there will be people in your area that will hear you appearing on model rail radio. So if you do get positive feedback from your local model railroading community associated with your appearance on model rail radio, really fun chatting with you, Fred. Please do call back in.
Surprisingly, I wanted to go to sleep 2 hours ago or something, but the thing was is that I saw your post on Facebook, and I'm like, I was talking to a friend, another real friend who actually is in New York somewhere, not city, the state. And I talked to him, and then I saw I was just going through Facebook newsfeed. Oh, there's something. And I'm looking at I'm going through the time zones, and I'm like, is that still now? So I searched Tom.BartBullet, and then, oh, he's on, except Franklin's. Oh my God, it's still going on, and here I am. So,
well, but the problem is, this normally happens a lot earlier, Fred. I'm just trying this as an experiment, doing a late night version of the show. We normally record at 6:30 p.m. your time, so normally it would be from about 6:30 through to maybe an hour or so, well, a couple of hours before this. So we also sometimes record in the morning as well, which would be about noontime your time on. But the trick is, as I'm assuming you're on the Facebook group, which is how you found out about this thing.
And I put a post saying, where do I find it?
It's been a pleasure chatting, Fred. Please do stay on the call if you can stay awake. And
I will. But the thing was is that I was gonna go sleep because in about 6, maybe 7 or 8 hours, out in Whedon on the UP Geneva sub west, there's a monthly train show called the Great Midwest Train Show. And it's at DuPage County Fairgrounds, and it's every month besides July. And I go there, and it's pretty much tomorrow, or technically today, actually, this morning. And I was going to sleep, and I was going to go out there with my friend who I've been with for 5 years. And I'm like, it's 1:18 in the morning, and I'm doing Model Railroad now. And, you know, missing the train show, given that it's 10 degrees outside and it snowed today or yesterday, you know, why go out there for maybe 3 or 4 hours to walk around in snow and cold and then come back and just, you know, I could skip it this month because it's so cold. And that's fine. I mean, if I skip it, there's always next month, of course. And very I get good. In for free because I have friends there. I can help out and everything. But I was planning on going, though. But now this is fine with me, too. So
very good, Fred. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. And yeah, I'm really actually, looking forward to
I never expected it to be – I actually never expected this many people to – or.
This is actually a small selection. We normally have about 20-plus people going. This is a smaller selection taken only from Facebook. I'm sure I'm going to get complaints because I only publicize the recording of this show through Facebook. But I understand your Chicagoland neighbor, Terry Gaskin, has some model railroading updates, so I'd like to get to Terry for it, but absolute pleasure chatting.
You're welcome.
Terry Gaskin.
Hi, Tom.
You have railroading updates. You must give us these model railroading updates. What are they?
Yeah, actually got some stuff done. Well, first off, I want to tell you I actually avoided a disaster in my basement because I had a leak. I had a plumbing leak. So I was able to dodge that bullet because I thought it was going to impact some expansion plans I had. So I had to install a new water softener. But luckily, I was able to do some creative piping.
Oh, you missed out on Ed Novitz's thing because of that.
Yes, that was actually that day. So it was quite an adventure to get that fixed. So I really thought I was going to have to lose this expansion I had planned to go to the other side of my basement because that's exactly where the water softener was. But I was able to jury-rig the piping to get the water softener. You have to sacrifice the water softener for the railroad, basically, is my view. So luckily, I got that done.
Very cool.
With that, I've got just built about 3 more feet of L structure, and this is a more detailed version that I'm casting out of resin. So this is completely detailed with rivets and all that good stuff where my previous structure wasn't. So that's kind of exciting. It's taking my structure to like a little higher level of fidelity. So I'm using a combination of, again, casting and a hand-pressed rivets, the whole nine yards. So that's been kind of fun.
Let me ask you a question, Terry.
Yes.
When you put these rivets on, do you count them at all?
I'll get that in a second. But I was able to find a set of metallic dies. I can't describe it. I have it on my blog, but it's a set of metal plates I ordered from Germany.
Ooh.
And now I can't find where I ordered it from because the website changed and all the instructions that I have are in German. So I can't, you know, Google Translate only goes so well. So I don't count rivets in terms of when I'm doing it on the girders. So I just kind of make enough rivets to fit.
Fair enough.
I was telling Mike I've been working on this 3D model of a rapid transit car from about 1920s that used to run in Chicago. It's called the 4000 series. So I've been learning the 3D modeling process, and I finally got the model done to a point where I actually took it A guy in Chicago, he's a renowned historian of the Chicago Transit Authority called Bruce Moffat. He's kind of like the historian who's wrote several books on the CTA history. I actually brought him my drawings and some test prints I made, and it passed. So Ooh. he approved it. I spent about a month poring over pictures and plans, and actually this is the time I actually did count rivets. So on the sides of the car and on the ends, I actually have exact number of rivets. The patterns match exactly, so I was really happy to have that done. So I got this to him, and we looked it over. I got a couple of things I need to fix. Some of the door controls that need to be moved over. Who knows? You know, a couple little minor details. So I've got that ready to go to Shapeways. So hopefully I'll get a couple prints out back in a couple of weeks and get a new car.
Very nice. So a question that's periodically asked, and oftentimes answered with photographs rather than words, how difficult is it to model something for Shapeways?
I found it to be, you know, pretty easy. I mean, I have a decent aptitude with the computer, so mm-hmm. I'm not really, you know, intimidated by the 3D modeling. I use SketchUp.
Mm-hmm.
It's
As
free.
Many do. Yep.
I find it to be relatively easy to use. What I really did to start, I took all the, I took basically the material limitations on Shapeways website. They have a table of like minimum wall thickness, minimum detail size. So I actually made a table of those and translated it to like O-scale real world. So looking at like the FUD product of Shapeways, I think the minimum you can go is like a quarter inch in O-scale. So I figured, okay, if I make all my details say like that, or, you know, I think I went to like a half inch to say any detail I can make a half inch or higher, I can do. So I always try to keep in mind that it have to be printed, because obviously with the 3D, you can go perfectly to scale, but then it may not print. So everything I've submitted has always been able to be printed. So I haven't had any problems. It's actually, for me, it's been pretty easy. You know, I've heard some people saying that they have some problems with the way the orientation.
Yeah.
Or
and the voids and all that kind of stuff. There seems to be a number of, yeah. It's interesting, actually, that, yeah, I think there's a kind of mindset. I mean, Jim Lincoln's a good example of this.
You're right. You have to know going in that it's going to. Well, I looked at it two ways. Number one, I looked at it going in that it has to be printed, so I have to. You have to make some compromises with your actual fidelity to the prototype. So I can't make it perfectly, but I have to keep that. And number two, I tried to keep in mind if I ever wanted to make a casting of this.
Yeah.
It's like the ends of the car. It's basically my car. It's O scale, so it's too large to be like printed as one shell. So I got two sides, two ends, and a roof. The ends are too complicated to be cast because it's got all kinds of undercuts and whatnot. But the sides I made to actually make a casting of. So I kept that in mind when I was making the model. So that way I knew when I got the print back, I could actually just make a casting of it. So you just have to keep that in mind. And if you do keep that in mind, I have not found any problems.
You're timing this perfectly. Peter, do you have audio?
I do now.
Peter, you have been going through an adventure with not 3D printing through Shapeways, but actually having a bona fide 3D printer in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit? I didn't want to necessarily cut Terry off
mid-sentence,
but this has just been a phenomenon that I've observed via Facebook updates. And I'd like to hear your long-form discussion associated with some of the experiments that you've had with your 3D printer since it arrived.
Well, I bought a Form 1 3D printer, which is by a group of MIT students who made a beautiful device. And what's interesting about the Form 1 is that it's a stereolithography machine. It uses a ultraviolet laser, which shoots this beam through an optical vat into resin, and it creates very fine layers. So it's able to create a finer resolution than, say, the fused deposition machines that most people have, like the MakerBot. It's a little bit more sophisticated that way, but it's also a little bit more temperamental. But it's a very high resolution machine. I bought it for my business, but of course, I'm using it for my hobby primarily. And, the reason I bought the machine, even within the business, is just the idea that, there's something that you can do when you're actually experimenting and working directly with a machine that you can't do when you're working in a mediated way through a service. So Jim Rint and Mike Slater and Jason Reese and Jim Lincoln have all shared files with me, and I've been experimenting with printing their files in different orientation along with my own files on the Dick Kirk project I've been working on, just to see what's possible. And we've gotten some phenomenal results, but, you know, ultimately, you know, the big lesson that I've learned is that, you know, certain ways of orienting the part and other things make a big difference in the result. And having the variety from the sort of little model rail radio community has made a huge difference in my ability to test these things.
The one thing I want to say, you brought up a great point, is that the fact that you have the machine there and don't have to wait on Shapeways, because it happened to me where Shapeways was having a Black Friday sale, so I rushed to get like a model done, and I had an error in it. One of the window sizes was too small. So when I got it back, I'm like, whoops, because, you know, if you have the machine, you get that instant gratification to see what mistakes you've made. And so I think that that would just be great to have, because that way you can say, whoops, I goofed up. I just didn't waste $30 on a print that is the window's wrong size.
Yeah, and you know, and there's also that, and also, like, for instance, I was printing Jim Lincoln has built a new bolster for a O-scale truck, and I've been experimenting with that. And, you know, I find that I could orient that part on the build platform in 6 or 7 or 8 different ways. And there are some ways in which I orient that part and it prints as a disaster. And there are other ways in which I orient that part and it prints perfectly.
What's the resolution of your machine as compared to, like, Shapeways? Is it?
It's very good. I mean, essentially the smallest free standing detail that Form 1 advertises is 1/3 of a millimeter for a freestanding detail. And the layer thickness is 0.025 millimeters. So it's very fine as compared to, say, you know, the MakerBot. So it's not as fine as Shapeways advertises for some other finer products. But ultimately, you know, it's like you can tickle the tiger's tail a little bit when the machine's actually there. I mean, there are things that, in printing this, I've been working on the journal box for the Dick Kerr. And the thing with working on that journal box is it's like I've got a lot of pieces that are below the minimum thickness. I've got some bolt heads that are below the minimum resolution, but I'm able to get them to print well. And I think when you have the machine right there in front of you, you can push the limits in a way that when you're working with a service and you don't have control over the part orientation, you don't necessarily have the ability to do.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what somebody on one of the Shapeways forums, somebody actually asked one of their developers, would they ever offer a service where you could recommend what orientation you would like to have the item printed in? And they flat out kiboshed that. They said, no way, we're never going to do that.
But, you know, what else is interesting, though, is like one of the pieces that I've been printing was a piece that, you know, Mike Slater had designed for Jim Rindt of the spiral column, which I think has been discussed on this, you know, on the podcast before. And, you know, Mike sent me the file and I had a difficult time printing it at first because of the resolution of the mesh. And, you know, Mike subsequently remeshed it. And, you know, I was able to get a great print off of it. And it also occurs to me that just even if Mike and Jim ultimately print their work at Shapeways, the ability to test it on this machine, you know, might be a good testing process to see, you know, how to optimize their files a little bit. So, you know what I mean? I think that's part of it is just experimenting with it and seeing what we can do and seeing what works and what doesn't.
Well, you're right, because that experimenting just gets expensive of Shapeways, and then the fact that the time factor, there's such a delay in when you get your, you know, your items, and it's, you know, then you've got all the extraneous of, like, cleaning it and doing all that fun stuff.
But, I mean, and I have to really head, you know, give hats off to the people at Form 1, because, I mean, I've got a, you know, in my workshop, I mean, because of my professional work, I've got a laser cutter. And I've got a subtractive rapid prototyping machine. And I have to say they've made the barrier to entry as minimal as possible for a technology this sophisticated, you know. And that's been really, really cool to experience.
Well, and I just went and clicked on your link, and it's not an exceptionally expensive printer. I mean, it's $3,300, which is still very expensive. But when you think about it, you know, it's doable. I mean, it's not so horrendous. You know, it's laser printer cost, but it's, I'm still stuck with Shapeways, but, you know, that would be fantastic to have, because that we could just, you know, it's that instant gratification of knowing that something is definitely not going to work and you just need to look in a different direction.
But, you know, I think there's also just the larger thing is that we all form communities, and, you know what I mean? There's no reason for everyone to have one of these machines.
True.
And you know, the other thing is as long as enough of us collaborate in a productive enough way, you know, because the thing is, for my part, is like I'm modeling a lot. And I've been working on modeling these Dick Kerr parts and other parts. But, you know, to be honest with you, it's like I can't possibly make enough models to keep this printer busy. So, you know, it's really actually, you know, in terms of collaborating with Jason and Mike and those guys, it's really actually been a blessing for me because it's given me a variety of files that I wouldn't have been able to test otherwise.
Well, then I'll have to get a hold of you because I got all kinds of stuff I need to print too. But I'm happy with the way my car came out, and I'm looking forward to making some. You know, I'm just going to open it up for the local traction community through like a Shapeways shop, and if anybody wants to order one. So I was happy about that, but I was more happy that the people who know these cars intimately were able to give me a thumbs up. So that was really nice to see, because I spent a lot of time counting and redoing and getting the measurements just right. So that was nice to see. But, you know, it's a, so the one bolster you said was for a seven inch gauge.
No, the bolster I was making for is, we've got a bunch of stuff. I mean, Jason has got some stuff for some larger scale things. I've been making some 14 millimeter stuff. And then Jim Lincoln had some proto 48 stuff.
Ah.
And then Jim Rintz stuff is, architectural and N scale.
Okay.
And really a wide variety. And I mean, to be honest with you, I've been just really impressed with the resolution of the machine and getting to know it. I mean, the big thing for me, the whole thing with the stereolithography technology versus the fused deposition technology or subtractive rapid prototyping technology is that it's fundamentally an optical technology where you're shooting a laser through an optical surface, through an optical silicone layer, into a vat of molten sticky stuff. And, just understanding how to condition your resin and how to manage it. I mean, the big learning curve for me has not so much been the 3D modeling stuff, because I've got some, you know, familiarity with that. The big learning curve for me is how to manage my resin bath. Mm. And, it's very interesting. You know, it's like there are just certain things that you have to get intimately acquainted with to make it work.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that I found that was difficult is just getting accurate drawings, because that's, you know, you really have to scour the earth sometimes to find stuff. But it was kind of nice. I was able to put out a call for a one-off car that ran years ago that's long since been scrapped. And literally 5 minutes later, somebody sent me a set of plans. So it's the community definitely helps in these things. And that's nice to know.
Yeah. And then there's also just the kind of decisions you make when you're translating the drawings to something to build, because, you know, one thing that I find, and this is regardless of whether you're using subtractive prototyping or 3D printing, is that, you know, within the virtual space, you can model something to an infinite level of detail. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, you have to have an awareness of the detail level that you're going to output it at, so that you can model it at an appropriate level of detail for the scale you're going to put it out at, I think something you were discussing before.
Yeah, you have to, because that's the one thing I found. It was like, because with Shapeways, I just use that because it's free. I try to get, you know, some of the other more complicated CAD programs, but, you know, free is free. So when you can actually type in, you know, actual measurements down to the 16th of an inch, and you go, well, this window on the plan is 12 and 15 16ths inches wide, and I type that in, and it's like, well, is 15 16ths of an inch really going to print? Is anyone going to really, you know? So you have to, you know, you just gotta, that's why I, you know, but I did find a something that was odd. So one of the things is because I do three rail, and so the three rail cars that I have aren't quite scaled. They're more like about like a 1/45th scale rather than 1/48. It's that kind of like three rail quasi O scale. Who knows what it is? But so I first off tried to make a car that would fit onto an existing chassis that, and without having that, those plans that actually had clear number dimensions, that was a darn right impossible to do. So it's nice to have like, okay, if this door is 3 feet wide and then the next space is 2 feet wide, it was, you know, just coming up with something out of your head was, is impossible. So it is nice to have the plans, but you're right. You need to take into account that one of the things I'm doing is obviously I'm adding rivets to the car. And so you realize, well, the rivet in itself is probably like 3/8 of an inch in diameter, maybe like 1/4 inch high, but that'll never print. So you do have to make it oversized. You have to be cognizant of that. And well, you know what? People are just going to have to deal with it because there's just a limitations to the technology.
You know, or you got to decide when it's worth modeling the hex bolt or when you just want to make a little round dimple.
Yep. Yeah. So it's, I'm looking forward to it. And I was just more tickled pink that the guy who wrote the book on it basically said, yo, it looks good to me. Go ahead. You know, everything looks good. So that, you know, that kind of gives you that nice little warm fuzzy feeling that you're not, you know, barking down the wrong thing. But, kind of, as a little side note, as a, talking about those rail fans. So I was at this trolley night tonight and we were watching old 8mm movies that somebody, you know, transposed to DVDs. Of like old rail fans in a, from, I don't know, like 1950, 1960, all these old steam excursions that the Burlington used to run or who knows what. But again, that kind of crazy rail fan, they were telling all the stories. So I think that's kind of, it's been throughout time that rail fans are
time on a tradition.
You know, some of the stories they were telling about, you know, the crazy people and they'd run into, or the one guy would always wear a cowboy outfit, or the one crazy lady would be on all the trips, and the one lady would always get really close to the track until she got run over by a North Shore car and got her leg cut off. I mean, there's all kinds of, yes. You know, so I think what you're saying is, you know, it's kind of always been around.
Very
so,
good, Terry. You know. Yeah, when they refer to themselves or maybe as others as foamers, I always just imagine people foaming at the mouth. That seems to be the image that I get when I hear rail fans referred to as foamers. Maybe it's
that's the image that's supposed to be portrayed, Tom.
Very good.
But that's my update. So thanks for having me. And once I get everything like printed or painted and all that good stuff, I'll throw some pictures up on the Facebook group.
Terrific, Terry. Always a pleasure catching up. And Peter, thank you as well for your update. Andy, do you have audio?
I do. Can you hear me?
We can hear you perfectly, Andy.
Excellent.
I have been thoroughly enjoying. I think I'm living vicariously through your Facebook photo updates currently.
Good.
Can you, for folks listening in who aren't part of the Facebook group, you have had, you're literally, it appears, taking, it's a bit like when people break the bank, when, you know, they withdraw money and the banks run out of money. You've been taking so much wood from your local hardware stores, apparently, that they've run out of wood.
They've run out of wood, I've run out of money, too.
I wasn't sure who'd run out of what, but for folks listening in, can you describe what you've been doing over the past few, weeks, months?
Well, it was the last couple of weeks, really, since Christmas. I got the room ready just before Christmas. Then the mother-in-law came, had Christmas. And with all the other decorating we've been doing in the house, because we only moved in September, I was finally ready to go. So I took the carpet up and redecorated the room. I took Peter Burr's advice and kept the room clean and tidy so that the family would want to come in.
Very good.
I bought some... They're basically kitchen unit carcasses, 1,000-unit double cupboards, really, and use those as a basis for the peninsula in the middle of the room. Because I've got the room that I'm using in our old house would have been my recording studio for the music. So I've got all the stuff from that and books and all the man stuff in the house, really. So I needed somewhere to put that. So these units were the first choice, really. So instead of building cupboards, it was much easier just to go buy a not ready-made, they come in flat packs, so you have to put them together. So I started with those. And I'd written, drawn a sort of a rough plan of what I what I wanted. And when we'd moved in the house, I'd put a load of boxes around just to sort of give a general feel for the space. Mm. And then basically changed the boxes for these units. Once I'd put these down, I think I've used six, maybe seven of them. I can't remember now. That was the base, and then started putting the wood on top of that. And I didn't start out with a plan. I mean, everything that I've done so far has just sort of happened as I've gone along.
Yes.
I've looked at it and thought, how can I put this part here, and how can I go up to the door? How can I come around the corner? And taken it each section by section. Now, Dom, I've done a bit. I've taken a picture and posted it, and you've seen what I mean.
So in terms of when we last had you on, you were describing three separate layouts, UK, American, and Swiss, I seem to recall.
Yes, yes.
This new layout that you are building in front of our eyes seems to all be connected in some way, or is it still the same three different layouts idea?
It's still going to be three separate layouts. It's okay. Changed somewhat because when I put the peninsula in, I was standing back at it, and I was only going to have the original first level, which was going to be the UK layout on the peninsula. And I looked at it, and it was, it's, I don't know, 11 feet by four, maybe at its widest. And I thought, and I was just looking at it, and I'm thinking, well, really for a terminus station, which is really what it was going to be, and village. And I thought, this is all in N scale. I thought, well, this is going to be rather large. So I put it on Facebook and asked the question, would it be better if I put a scenic divide in the middle? And most people thought that was a better idea than having it completely open with being able to see the entire room as you walked in. Not that having it open was a bad idea. It was just, you know, there's always two ways to do things, if not four. But then thinking about the scenic divide in the middle, I looked at it and thought, well, why not carry on the three tiers through the peninsula as well? So the way that the base units were put together, they're all bolted together, there was a sort of a gap through the middle, which I put uprights in, and I've hung everything off of that, really. So therefore, it will come round the room, join the peninsula, go round the peninsula, and back round the room again. Now, originally, the UK layout was going to be the first level. The Swiss and Japanese was going to be on the second level, and the American was going to be on the third. Now, since I've put the peninsula in and the divide in the peninsula, I've since changed my mind on that, and I'm going to put the Swiss at the top, and only the Swiss going round the peninsula, not round the wall, mainly because it can come along one side of the peninsula, round, and keep travelling up. This will be Swiss meter gauge, so it's mainly mountain railway, and it's going to go up. And the top level of the peninsula now will be mountain, so it can come up and it can do several passes. So basically a helix from the outside, if you will.
Certainly.
So then that will mean that the Japanese will then run round the wall. Mm. And then the American one will now drop to the second tier, which I have to say is now got the supports in the centre. You can see that's really ideal level for actually viewing anything, really. Mm. The UK is, I think, 54 inches. I'd say what it is. I've written it down somewhere. I can't remember. It's very early in the morning here.
Certainly.
So, yeah, the American will now be in the centre. The other issue I've had lately is an uncle of mine has given me all his 00 stuff.
Oh, yes.
So I've now got a very large amount of 00 equipment. So that's caused me, no, it's not caused me any problems. It's sort of like, now what do I do with it? Mm. I'm tempted to think, well, I'll maybe construct some, I wouldn't say temporary, I don't know, some smaller shelf layouts in the garage, perhaps, that I can so, move around.
Again, this has been... I feel obligated to describe to people who are not on the Facebook group. I mean, the first step is, why aren't you on the Facebook group? But following that, the volume of 00 equipment that you've received, my understanding and my recollection is that it required multiple car trips in order to get it.
I picked it up at Christmas, and we picked up the mother-in-law and presents and mm-hmm. various other things. It's a, I don't know, it's a 500-mile round trip back mm-hmm. to where we used to live in Dorset. So I couldn't fit it all in. So I had to get the second box when we took the mother-in-law home. It really is, I mean, this, I don't know, 10 locomotives, no end of coaches, freight. But they're not all, it's a very eclectic mix.
Certainly.
So that also makes me think, well, what actually am I going to do with it? Not that, you know, I can't, but it's coming up with something sensible with it all, I think. We've got old Great Western, we've got LNER, no end of stuff. So that'll be interesting on its own, but that's, I'm not particularly in a hurry to do it, although obviously he's given it to me thinking, well, he's taken his layout down and mm-hmm. he was going to leave it to me in his will, but he said, well, I don't know, you do it and I'd like to see you do something with it. So I've really...
So you really have an obligation now to actually do something.
Absolutely, but he's not in any sort of... I don't think he's going to pop off anytime soon. So I've got a bit of time, so we'll worry about that when I get to it.
Okay. Yeah, the photographs I found very inspirational in terms of a potential change of direction, although you've remained persistent associated with your current vision. But I thought you could actually do some interesting stuff with the space that you had available with the locomotives and rolling stock that you have now received. But if your plan is not to put any of pollute your layout plans of this currently, more power to you.
I would never say never. What I think I might do is once I've got the... I'm really putting the skeleton in. Once I've got the... I'm going to put some board on some of it. I'm going to put some spline in other parts. Really, I've got a bit of 00 track, but I haven't got much. What I would like to do is actually lay some out. I'll get some and sort of see what is possible. But okay. I really think my vision of whether it be N or 00 is sweeping curves. If I had to have anything, a smaller curve than it should be, then I would have it hidden. And you would, in 00, in a room my size, to sort of double back on itself, in even in 9 foot, that's still quite a tight turn. So, and that would jar with me. So I know it's, you know, you do what you have to. I'm thinking more along the lines of it would be an end to end with the 00, which would suit the garage quite well, I think. There is plenty of space down there, so we'll wait and see.
Andy, it's always a pleasure catching up with you. I'd like to have the opportunity to chat with you, but I really do enjoy your Facebook updates as well. And I'm
I was beginning to think, well, you know, am I posting too much? Because every time I put a bit in, I take a picture and post it.
Not at all. No, I think you should post more, in fact. If it requires daily updates, we'll get daily updates from you, Andy.
You might have to wait till I can afford some more wood.
Yes. I think you need to set up some kind of charitable donation scheme associated with wood. Always Maybe. A pleasure chatting, Andy, and please do keep posting, because I'm certainly living vicariously through your posts currently. They're much appreciated.
Excellent. Thank you, Tom.
I'd like to welcome on Dan Pickard. Dan, you've already featured on Model Rail Radio this evening. We had Murray on a little earlier, and he was talking about getting his layout ready for you, and I think Laurie Green, and maybe a couple of other folk coming through.
But that's right.
You are in your transit, stopping off at Murray's, but then you are heading to an O-Scale convention in Sydney.
Yeah, well, I'm actually calling into Murray's on the way home. It's from where I live down in like southern Victoria. It's just short of 1,000-kilometre drive up to Sydney, or about 700 miles, for a one-day exhibition, which is bit of a hike for probably less than 24 hours up in Sydney, but it's a show that I'm really looking forward to, given it's a 10-year celebration of the O Australia Group, or the 7 Mils of Oz Modelling Group in Australia, and their forums they often have. And but they're putting on an open exhibition of purely O-scale displays, which is a bit of a rare thing. You spoke with Prof on the last show, I think it was. And,
the show before last.
Well, the show before, that's right. And, so he mentioned there's a number of layouts which are getting built especially for this. And I know a lot of the 7mm modelers up around the New South Wales area, and even some of the Victorian guys, they're great modelers and they're very passionate about what they do. And I'm really excited about getting up there for day to check out what's on hand. So, and I've been busy. I'm running all day sort of revolving tree clinics throughout the course of the day.
Gosh.
I think I'll probably repeat my clinic about 8 or 9 times throughout the day. And my headache of the last couple of weeks has been reducing down what's normally about an hour's long clinic. I'm trying to squeeze it down to around about 20 minutes.
Gosh.
Just so that people don't get tied up at clinics and they sort of keep interest and they get a bit of an insight of how I go about doing that sort of modelling.
Mm.
And I've been doing lots of fine-tuning and cutting and snipping and rearranging clinic schedules and bits and pieces to try and get that happening. So, and dusting off a few layouts and displays to take up there for the show. So, but then seeing Murray is only a very short diversion off the road up there. He's going to break up my trip on the way home and call in, and no pressure, Murray, but I hope that most of the scenery is finished.
Have you seen his layout previously?
Only via internet and, photos of postings, he's emailing backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. Updates or
video about 9 months ago that I referred to. And I was actually amazed how little of his layout was finished from that, because I mean, talking to him, and you said get some beautiful photographs, I mean, obviously from Narrow Gauge Down Under as well. You do get the sense that his layout's considerably more finished than when you actually see it in the open space, but he said he's run a train from end to end. That was his big update news. But I think you guys are probably going to be in for a treat. I mean,
I'm certainly looking forward to it. I'm quite envious of the space he's got, but I guess living on the size property he's got, there's no sort of restrictions on what size shed you are entitled to put up in your backyard. I'm finally getting towards putting up my new shed for my little studio space, and it's only going to be about a quarter of the size of what he's got.
Yes.
I am a little bit jealous of that. I think he's had a few sort of delays with chops and changes with themes and sort of areas he's going to model. And I think he's set in his way now. He's finally, I think, made a clean decision on where he's heading with it.
Yes.
Which gives you good targets. I mean, you don't dabble around and chop and change. He's got a clear picture of what he wants now, I think. And, I'm really looking forward to finally catching up with Murray in his home and seeing what it is he's got to enjoy when he's not out ploughing fields. So,
The quality of his wood modelling. I have more an olfactory sense of what Murray's layout would be like. I just imagine, the multiple kind of eucalypts and the fact that he uses natural timber and all this kind of stuff and his modelling. I mean, obviously the underframe is all steel construction.
Yep.
But, I'm looking forward to one day visiting Murray's layout as well, and I will live vicariously through your experience here, Dan.
Oh, I imagine it'll be a worthwhile trip.
Definitely. Well, good catching up, Dan. In terms of your space, you said the shed is about to be the structure that you've got to be built is nearly, is it ready? Is the semester closed? What's the state associated with
it? I think I updated some time ago that I was eventually going to be building this shed, and to be honest, I've done minimal modelling since about October last year. It's just been we started a little idea of re-landscaping our front yard, and that rolled on into the front lounge room, which rolled on into the main living space, which then continued down to the back rumpus room.
Change is a wonderful thing.
I'll be happy when it's done, but I'm doing far more hard labour than what I'm doing actual modelling time at the minute. But one of the parts I am doing is converting some attic space. We had a reasonable sort of area above our back rumpus room, which I needed to put a little access hole into. And when I put my head up there, it was quite a good clearance up there. And with the shed I'd been planning on building, which is going to be, I think it was about 4 meters by 6 meters. The boss slash wife kept giving me a list of all these new bits and pieces, you know, all these items which would need to be stored out into this new shed.
Certainly.
Which kind of defeated the purpose of why I was building it, to try and condense all of my model railway paraphernalia from, you know, out of the study, out of the garage, out of the spare room, all into one space so that we actually get some more appropriate storage and stuff back at home.
Mm-hmm.
And so by putting the effort in to put up this attic, and I've gained a considerable amount of storage room, and that means that the shed will stay all train-related rather than half storage. So I'm happy with that. But it's at a bit of a standstill at the minute because Australian summer has finally popped its head up, and, you know, these strings of 40-degree days and bushfires around locally again, you know, today and in the last couple of weeks. It's no fun being up in the roof at the minute because it's probably pushing 60, 70 degrees up there. So I've got about 3/4 of the way finished. And as far as the shed in the backyard goes, I've got as far as I've at least been out with a bit of poison and killed off the grass. So I know the footprint now.
Very good.
So I can stand out on a pile of dead grass and really get a feel for what I'm going to have to play with.
Very good.
So you lots of Imagineering.
Yeah, you did have a couple of pieces from a friend of yours layout.
Yep.
That you were going to put in. Are they, have you taken them apart or are they still structurally similar?
Well, that was part of the ploy to really get the shed going.
Certainly.
And I know that my wife doesn't listen to these radio shows, so I can mention all this stuff. But that was part of Gavin Hintz's old layout. He's the editor of Narrow Gauge Down Under.
Certainly.
And I put some photos up on the Facebook page some time ago, but work hasn't been done on that part of the layout since, you know, October when we started the renovation part. But, yeah, there's certainly I was able to remove all the lightweight sort of foam chunks of scenery out of those old timber modules of Gavin's, and I've got aluminium framing up. And what's the parts that would have been featured on the Facebook page back then, it's going to be another portable exhibition layout, but that'll eventually become housed into the home layout. It's probably about a quarter. But the part that'll be exhibition layout will be about a quarter of the home layout. And the idea was to, I was sort of getting a bit frustrated with going to model shows and seeing the same style of layout. So I was trying to make something which is a little bit more, it looks more like what a home layout could be. It's not normal shapes. It's got odd protrusions and different shapes and that sort of stuff to it. So it can give people, when they go to exhibitions, more of an idea of what a home layout could be rather than what a large club layout could be. So, but it's, that's certainly all going to be incorporated into the new area. And, I was also able to pick up, there were some former pieces of the old Red Stag layout, which a number of models will be familiar. I managed to collect a number of little feature pieces of that, so that'll be incorporated as well with a little Red Stag corner, which will be highly improper for people who are into more fair income Australian logging scenes. But the story will be that there's an American relative associated into it who's imported all this American logging themes.
Fair enough.
Which will be a little memorabilia corner of the layout. So lots of little projects, and I'm really quite itching to get all these home renos finished so I can get back and get my hands dirty again. It's I've had, I think, 2 exhibitions which have been, like, you know, just weekend shows while we've been doing these renovations, and that's probably totaled my modelling time in the last 6 months, I suppose. So one of the
features I like the most from your modelling, and your tree modelling in particular, and some of the trees that you make are huge, but they're still not prototypical in terms of their size. What role will trees play, and in particular your signature style trees?
Huge.
The layout that you're proposing.
The current plan I've got, and I probably got the best impression of it going back a couple of weeks ago. I had my local exhibition, just around the corner for me. And I took along my little Digger's Bend layout, which is, I think I've had some photos of that. And I had my Splitter's Gorge bush box. I also had, it was my mantelpiece, a little diorama from the Australian Narrow Gauge Convention, which is a, little scene of like Puff and Billy country.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my other Australian sort of dioramas, and they're all lined up in a row. So it was about 4 meters of my Australian sort of modeling. And that was the first time I've actually laid all four items up in a row. And it really was just a wall of gum trees. And gave me the best impression of what my shed's going to feel like when I walk into it. Probably at least half of the shed will be heavily populated with what would be like dense otways, rainforest sort of, which is, you know, not far from where I live.
Certainly.
I'm having a guess that I'm probably going to have something like 1,500 to 2,000 trees to build, you know, across the lifetime of this layout. So it's certainly going to keep me busy for probably the next 20 years, which is the intention, I think, is I don't want to finish it straight away and get bored with it. I want to, I want to keep the creativity going for a long time. So,
and the trees will play a role on the transportable show portion of the layout as well.
Yeah, so that'll be probably the heaviest sort of treed section of it.
Wonderful.
There's the peninsula piece which extends out, which is portrays the end of a line. Which is it's sort of based on a little station that was called Crows, which was found at the end of the old Beach Forest line, which is the part of the VR narrow gauge line, which is closest to where I live. It was quite a desolate. It was like Australia's southernmost narrow gauge terminus. It was a really windswept, quite barren sort of area, which is in contrast to the forest which sort of surrounded it. So that'll be the feature sort of area. But behind that little windswept, you know, end terminus is heavily populated Australian logging with, you know, tall mountain ash trees and plenty of gums and ferns sort of in amongst it. So, yeah, a couple of thousand trees and probably double the amount of little tree ferns I need to source and make. So lots of scenery coming up in the next half of my lifetime, I think. So.
Wonderful, Dan. Wonderful. Dan, it is always a pleasure catching up with you. I'm looking forward to once you're done with these renovations and you can focus more time on your modelling. And I'm not sure whose responsibility it is, but when you get up to Sydney, if you can take a few snaps of, in particular, the prof's work. The prof posted a few photos associated with putting his stuff together, but I'm really interested in seeing what he finally assembles in the end.
I'll have a fresh little memory card ready to go. Terrific. I'm sure I'll be taking a healthy amount of photos. I'm sure there'll be a considerable amount of stuff to be photographed when I'm up there. So
yes,
I'll be very much looking forward to filling up the memory cards and coming back so I've got a good recollection of what I've been able to experience and be a part of. So.
And please feel free to post an unhealthy number of photos on the Facebook group because I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
I'm sure there'll be an album or two. There might be a Sydney one. There might even be a few updates of the Murray Skulls adventure, I think.
Terrific.
So.
Definitely. Always a pleasure chatting, Dan.
No worries. It's been a while, so hope to be on a bit more often now.
Not a problem. Good chatting.
No worries.
Peter Little, do you have audio?
I certainly do, Tom. How are you?
It's a little late here, but I stayed up so I could talk to the likes of you. This is your first time calling into Model Rail Radio. For folks listening in, would you like to introduce your model railroading interests?
Yep. I'm saying that I'm going to be, because I've only just restarted the hobby again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be doing an N-gauge layout made up of probably 2 6x2 boards as a yard. I think you probably appreciate by now we don't have a lot of space in the UK generally for housing layouts.
Certainly.
I started this in the garage. We've got quite a large detached garage. The lady of the house, Patricia, she's given me permission to bring it indoors into our office area.
Wonderful.
So I've got 2 6x2 boards permanently joined together, which form a 6x4 fiddle yard stroke storage area, and then I've got to devise a system whereby as a front, a third 6x2 will go on the front, and I'm hoping to do 3 sort of different layouts. So the first one I'm looking at, and I've got assistance from a local hobby shop as well, is to build an American scene.
Wonderful.
A USA scene or Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
I've got an interest in UP and CP, so Northern California, I take it, up to Portland, Oregon, there, up that way.
Certainly.
Then a second board would be a UK scene, from what era I don't know yet, but I prefer modern day to Steam. And then a third board would be continental, so something around Holland, Germany way.
Wonderful, wonderful. So you're following a similar theme. I'm not sure if you had a chance to listen to Andy Dixon's audio, but there seems to be a need with little space to maximise the modelling possibilities through. So when you're planning on modelling Northern California through to Oregon, what kind of things are you looking to put on that layout in particular?
The research, and I'm doing quite a bit of research, which is so easy these days with the internet and books and what have you. The research is sort of leading me to it's very difficult to describe. I'm almost looking upon the lines of building a diorama.
Certainly.
Rather than something that would be, I know from what I gather from, I listen to all the shows, I've caught up on all the old modern radio shows in the car driving to and from work. Rather than having an actual operating layout where people come and relive, shall we say, an actual operating sequence, I'm more interested in creating something that reminds me of part of a line or an area. So therefore, many, many years ago, in about early 70s, might have been early 1970s, I was in the United States on work and was up near the Portland area and was just stunned by scenery.
Mm.
And then scenery with railway, or railroads as you call them, railroads in them, it stayed with me for the rest of my life. And that's the sort of thing I'd be looking at. It's very difficult to describe. I think until I start putting some track down, I don't think anyone really has an idea where they're going to go.
Certainly. But in 6x2,
mm-hmm.
The kind of track that you can put down in terms of, you know, double track mainline, you know, maybe spurs, some turnouts, what have you.
Yeah.
You still have a relatively... So my recollection of Portland, and particularly the areas that you're describing, potentially, have some undulation in them. They're not all flat. Would that be something that you would consider in your vignette layout associated with Northern California and Oregon?
I think I'm going, because of space restriction, and it is purely that, mm-hmm. I think I'm going to end up with perhaps a double line with a passing loop,
mm-hmm.
and then everything will run automatically out of the fiddle yard, storage yard, I'm not quite sure what else you call them,
certainly.
Over the water, as we say. So therefore, it's for me, it's seeing trains run. It's not for me, I don't know that it's necessarily the scenic modelling or the modelling of buildings or what have you, although I think I'll probably get interested in that and will make a conscious effort, but it's more for me seeing trains run. It really is. So even if I have two lines and a passing loop with a small siding, I'll be satisfied with that and I'll try and build some scenery around that. It's just purely space. I suppose really, if you think about it, if I did away with the fiddle yard shunting area at the back, I would have a 6x6 or a 6x4 layout, which I could do all sorts with.
Certainly.
If I didn't want to do the three different scenes. So I suppose I could do something American railroad type stroke Canadian railroad over a 6x4 board and design it so that the scenery could be, say, like Scotland in the UK.
Certainly.
So I could just change the rolling stock and the locomotives. I don't know. A lot of this is going to come together as I start putting track down in a loose fashion.
Yes.
I mean, I'm looking at the Facebook page daily, and some of the stuff you have over there is just phenomenal. I mean, just it. And what Andy's doing, that's amazing as well. And Tom, is it Tom C?
Yes, Tom Cutting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What they're doing is amazing. So I've got a lot of thinking to do, Tom, I'll be honest. I'm just taking inspiration from the likes of people like Lionel, and Seth Newman and Jim Lincoln. Yeah. Well, I understand Jim's probably not doing much on the railway front at the moment.
Well, the chocolate photos are actually inspiring people currently. It's interesting, actually, when we had Jim on initially when he was planning the chocolate, I made the point to him somewhat tongue-in-cheek that the purpose of the chocolate was really so he could build a layout in the shortest amount of time that would keep up his interest so he'd actually finish it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he's done. I think the chocolate is actually inspiring a lot of people to rethink what they use Google Maps for in terms of, you know, not just top-down inspiration when you're, you know, designing a track plan, but actually printing out and using as a modelling guide, which is really a phenomenal way of using Google Maps.
Yes. As I say, the other thing with this, Tom, is, and first of all, let me say that Modern Rail Radio, you have hit upon something that someone should have done years ago.
I believe that quite sadly. I wish someone else had done it years ago, but anyway.
Yeah. And I think everyone appreciates the effort you obviously put into this. But as sheer inspiration, it's marvellous. The only thing with it is there is so much coming out of it.
Certainly.
That you listen to a show, and I listen to it on my iPod or in the car or whatever. And do you know what? I come away more undecided than when I went in. Because yes. I hear things and I think, ooh, that's brilliant. Like Terry Terrence's launch pad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I started looking at that the other week because I heard it on the programme. And then I've got different ideas running through my brain about the fiddling yard or switching yard. And that threw me out slightly because I'm suddenly thinking, oh, perhaps I'm going in the wrong direction. Perhaps I need to look at this.
Yes.
And that. And then I picked up, Richard, over there, you have he's not alive anymore. You have a famous photographer called Richard Steinheimer.
Mm-hmm.
And I started reading one of his books, and he got some pictures there of West Coast USA.
Yes.
And that put further ideas in my head and threw the ideas I got from Terry Terrence out the door. And I think until I just get this track down, I am not going to really know where I'm going.
Yes.
It's fascinating. I mean, there is just so many avenues to go down. As you can hear, I'm so undecided about what I want to do. I have a clear vision, but how I actually put that down onto the board, I don't know. I really don't know. And I see all these ideas. There's the chap I was listening yesterday about bush boxes.
Yes.
You're obviously originally from Australia or whatever.
Well, you have to, Dan Pickard is one of the... I mean, you came just after Dan Pickard, who I don't know whether he's one of the pioneers, but he's certainly one of the... You know, one of the most amazing examples of bushbox creation. So your timing is perfect there, Peter.
Yeah, and I looked when he said that those dioramas are 18 inches deep. I was amazed. Yes. And you look at it and you think, now hang on a minute. I've only got 2 foot to play with if I did my original idea. But hang on, in 18 inches, he's produced something like that. What could I do with 24 inches depth?
Exactly.
So now that threw something else in the idea. Am I just going to do a scenic railway where the trains just go round and I spend some time doing the scenery? Monorail Radio has opened up so many ideas. I'm not confused. I'm just undecided.
Well, I think the critical thing, as you've noted, is just to get some track down. And once you have the track down, you can, you know, your vision maybe will be more focused on the track and the space and the, you know, the way... The techniques that Dan Pickard uses are just absolutely phenomenal. But they are also very well suited to the kind of bush landscapes that he is modelling.
Yes.
And in the stuff that you're describing, I mean, the density of vegetation through Oregon lends itself to techniques which you can use as well in terms of kind of dense vegetation, giving, as you say, a kind of greater depth of field. But yeah, I think, Peter, the trick is just to put some track down, maybe get a locomotive and a couple of bits of rolling stock, and see where your vision lies with these things, and then design the scenery around it, because I think what you're describing seems to lend itself to at least having some undulation, or maybe a particularly detailed photo backdrop. And again, I would go back and listen to Terry Terrence's discussion associated with that, because you'll get some insights in how to do that as well through Terry's discussion there.
Yeah. Well, being a railway photographer has been my main hobby for the last few years. I've got more than ample opportunity to take pictures and make a backdrop out of that anyway.
Certainly.
About 5 years ago, I discovered I was adopted, and I'd got a couple of half brothers and a half sister. Well, my half brother lives in Canada in Orangeville, so of course I've got the opportunity to go there and take some pictures and create a back scene and put that on as a backdrop as well. So I've got loads of things I can do. It's just that matter of putting that track down and just having a look and see where I can go with it, as you say. But I'll keep post. What I'm going to do is, once the board's up here in the office and I start loose laying track, I will actually post some pictures to the Facebook page.
Very good, Peter.
Yeah, then people can shout at me and say, no, you don't want to do that, you want to do this.
Well, that might actually be dangerous as well, Peter. I don't know, I'm hesitant to recommend people starting posting pictures. I would look at Andy Dixon as being a poster child of what happens when you start posting to the Facebook page.
Yes.
It could go in a wide variety of directions that you have absolutely no control over.
It could. But again, once again, Tom, I discovered this. It's taken me ages to listen to all, how many shows now? 83?
I don't know. I'd stop counting. I just add one to the number when I post it.
Yeah. And thank you for your efforts on it, because it's really opened it up. It's fabulous. And I'm hoping that myself, Andy, Tom C and one or two others, that will get more and more people interested within the UK. Because the hobby here has really taken off again.
Certainly.
And I put that partly down to the fact that the railways here are now having a large amount of investment, billions and billions thrown at them.
Yes.
We now have a variation of locomotives that we haven't seen since diesel and steam were running together.
Yes.
We've got, there must be 30, 40 odd different classes running around the UK now, some of them American built, as you well know, probably. And people are flocking back to the hobby. My local hobby shop, who is very good and stocks a good American railroad selection, he says things have never looked so good. So there's plenty going on, which is great. And I'd just like to get more people from the UK into this, onto this modern rail radio.
I would agree, Peter. And I thank you for any efforts that you can make getting more UK content. The problem seems to be that a lot of the UK content that we get on are folks who are, as you have, and as, although Andy really didn't need any prompting, they look at the American modelling and become immediately quite obsessed with the American modelling. I actually really like UK prototype modelling, and I'm hoping to get more folks from the UK who do UK prototype modelling on as well, because it's just, I spent, aside from being Australian and now living in the US, I spent 4 years in the UK, and it was, my wife as well, it was some of the nicest time we've spent anywhere. And travelling, I don't know what you think about travelling by train in the middle of last decade, but you could see quite a bit of eclectic locomotives and rolling stock through that period of time as well. Even though you would end up on decrepit track and sometimes on what I guess you'd call third-class rail routes in some circumstances. But I enjoyed travelling by train in the UK within the last decade as well. Although I understand things have got a lot better. So.
Yeah, they've vastly improved. I mean, they really have. It's quite amazing. It is the growth industry within the UK now. It's almost as though part of the interest of railways, and I'm sure this is the same in the States and Canada and Australia, wherever they're involved, Japan, there is the great thing with railways and railroads is there's history, engineering, politics. It's got so many diverse areas to it,
certainly,
which makes it interesting, and I think provides a link to everyone within the hobby. Someone has an interest of one of those somewhere within it. And one of the things here is that the politicians have stood back and allowed people just to invest money. Now, in the old days, we were considered, the UK was an aircraft carrier off of Europe for the United States, Canada and Japan to use as a trading post. And then that sort of died. We became part of Europe and we weren't used as this sort of trading stroke staging post. Well, that's now come back. We are the gateway to Europe now, and everything container-wise comes to a British port, and then we ship it across to Europe from here. So the rail freight traffic has increased tremendously. I mean, I think it's something, someone said it's like 300-400%. Absolutely amazing. So there's this big interest and big, how can I put it, just a resurgence [S2] Sure. [S1] Of interest, which is brilliant. So yes, it's when I get the when I post some pictures, I took down a blog, a railway photography blog. But if you call them up over here, there are pages and pages of railway photographers now.
Yes.
So the interest is phenomenal, and in American railroads and Canadian and Japan, there's a lot of interest here. I think now with Japan. Because in the similar vein, Tom, they have space restrictions
certainly
to us.
Yes, you actually, know, that's very interesting. That's an insight that a few people have made on these recordings over the years. But I do see the similarities, exactly as you say, because of space constraints.
Yeah, I certainly what I saw in Japan, and it was a long, long time ago, went on my world sort of working tour, the Japanese have this ability to put so much into a shelf, onto a shelf in railway terms. It's amazing. But then they have to pull something out, put it on a shelf, play with it for an hour, and then it has to go away.
Yes.
We're not so tight on space. We can leave a layout out, but it can't be large. So there are similarities. I understand from what I've heard of all the programs, you probably have the same problem where you are at the moment.
Yes, well, that's a phenomena. It's a very strange phenomena where I live currently. But my hope is, and my hope has been for the past couple of years, but my hope really this year is that we will be able to break out, and I will at least be able to have the same kind of civilized space that you have at your disposal currently. But Peter, it's 12:30 here. I'm kind of promised myself that I would round up around midnight, but having you on, I wanted to have a chance to chat with you. Been an absolute pleasure. What I'm going to do, I think this time actually is pretty feasible for a number of folk, and I think I might actually start floating three time formats, the regular 4 o'clock my time, and then potentially these, I don't know what you'd call it, 8:30 on times, as well as the morning time. The morning time for me works out well for UK participants and European participants because it's, afternoon, early evening for you folk. But it's been wonderful catching up and actually having the chance to... your name sounded familiar, and when you came on, I checked the archive because I've lost track of all the people that called in because I thought you may have called in on a previous UK show time, but I realised that actually you are, you know, you have posted on the Facebook group, haven't you?
I have, yes. Mainly because I find Lionel Strang, Seth and Jim, I find them, the way they talk and run their little bit of the off-program chat, I find fantastic. I can relate to it.
Certainly.
I've got all these messages going across the bottom of the screen at the moment, so... which is marvellous, and Andy's just asked me to join him on Facebook. So wonderful. It's brilliant. Thank you. All I can say to the guys, you and the guys over the pond as well, keep up the great work. When I come over to see my brother in Canada, and I don't know when it's going to be, it might be this year, but more than likely next year, I'm going to try and catch up with some of the guys and see the layouts.
Wonderful. I thoroughly recommend doing that, actually, because the phenomena of model rail radio in terms of people, in terms of locations, in terms of layouts, I think is, you know, one of the greatest phenomena. I mean, aside from just pushing the air particles through MP3s or what have you, the ability to actually meet people, and I put this out there and I've had people contact me since I last put it out, But if you are in an area and you feel that you are a lone wolf modeler, I'm pretty sure I can put you in contact with at least a couple, if not half a dozen folk, who are in your area as well. So if you feel that you're listening to Model Rail Radio purely as inspiration, you feel you're a lone wolf, but you would like to meet others who are similarly inspired, get in contact with me. I don't mind putting you in contact with folks that I know in your part of the world. Peter, I'm going to have to wrap this thing up, unfortunately, but it's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you. No, Tom, that's brilliant. Thank you very much. Thank you to everyone else. And you all have a good night in America, and that's from a very stormy UK at the moment.
Very good. Good chatting, Peter.
No, thank you.
So for folks listening in, this format, I think, has been a success. It's been a success on my end, at least, a little bit behind the scenes, because my wife is currently out and will get back tomorrow morning. So that may filter into it. I don't think I could be recording past midnight, in the current confines, if she was here. But certainly an evenings or, weeks where she is away, I think I could certainly float this format relatively easily. And I think certainly the places that we're looking at currently have train office podcasting rooms. I will just have to soundproof them accordingly. This has been a phenomenal format, actually. The folks who've called in this evening, probably most of them, well, obviously we have the usual regulars, but, some of the new callers have been really very inspirational. I'd like to send a shout-out in particular to Fred, because it's really nice to get a sense that there are folks in the hobby who are coming into it, who are teenagers, what have you, that are finding a degree of camaraderie, and certainly Fred's discussion associated with cyberbullying as well. The funny thing is, I really rarely have to do any censorship on the Model Rail Radio Facebook group. I do look at other Model Rail Riding Facebook groups occasionally and wonder, where the censorship might be needed. But we have an amazing community here, and I'm really very inspired by the folks who I have the opportunity to chat with on a regular basis. So the next show may be as soon as next weekend. I'm not sure when I'm going to get this audio out, but my hope is to do a recording next weekend because my wife is on a quilting tour of the Northern Bay area, so I will hopefully have the opportunity to record for a longer format. Thank you very much to the folks who participated this evening. A lot of inspirational stuff, and thanks to the folks also for listening in. Good night.
Good night, Tom. Thank you.
Night.
Good morning.
Good night.
Good night, everyone, or good morning as we are here.